Committee on Health and Human Services to order. Colleagues, a couple housekeeping things. Number one, Representative Westland's Audit Committee is going to commence a series of overview meetings. It's 3 o'clock today in room 50, and we are all invited to sit in on that. So, and there will be no meeting of this committee Friday.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What a good decision. I'm going to test those roads back over the hill, see if.
Yeah. Sergeant Arms, could you do something about this guy?
Please.
Okay, we will continue with what we were doing Monday with testimony from the department. And Barry, I think you're up. And Lynn, if you want to, you can tag team us. And committee, just for your information, they did give us a new and revised sheet that has some numbers on it this time. So this is the most current form we have, subject to change, I'm assuming.
Thank you.
Please, go ahead.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. And my name is Barry Cast. I'm the Assistant Director of the Department of Human Services for Health Services, and I'm joined by Lynn Reed, the Acting Administrator of our Office of Medical Assistance Programs, who's here to talk about the changes that may result in the Oregon Health Plan and other OMAP-operated services. As you can see from just even a brief review of this 12-page document, there are a considerable number of specific items from the November rebalance, the 5100, and the revenue forecast reductions. And we're pleased to walk through each of them for you, but I wanted to begin by highlighting some of the more significant reductions that are in this outline and emphasize how, in some ways, some of these work together to constrain what communities can do in the area of mental health and addictions treatment. I think of these as the most egregious or potentially catastrophic reductions resulting from these circumstances, and let me bring your attention to them.
Before you start, well, you've got a column for general fund savings and then a total fund savings. I'm assuming that maybe that could be more characterized, the total fund savings, as a loss of federal dollars rather than actual, it's savings to the nation, I'm assuming, but it's actually a loss of revenue to the state of Oregon. Would that be pretty accurate to say?
Yes, Mr. Chair, in those programs that are matched with federal funds or that depend on other resources.
Yeah, that's just for the committee. So, you know, for example, item three, where it's $2 million plus general fund savings and 4.7 total savings, that's actually a loss of that amount of federal revenue, the difference between the two.
I need to clarify that. If I could clarify, Lim Reed, Acting Administrator for the Office of Medical Assistance Programs, the federal fund amount is the difference between the total fund column and the general fund column.
I know, but okay. Really, where it's a cost to our book of business of that amount of federal funds, so it's not savings per se, it's actually an additional cost. Well, yeah, I just kind of want to make that point so everybody knew what that savings is somewhat speculative and that's heading for that column. So,
and in addition, Mr. Chair, I would just remind you that in Jean Thorne's testimony, she talked about the very high percentage of the department's budget, which is dependent on federal resources in a matching arrangement. So the general fund alone does not tell the whole story.
Right.
That first reduction that took place January 1st was actually a reduction from funds that were as yet unspent and uncontracted that were added to our budget by the 2001 legislature for caseload growth and program improvement for children's mental health, and in the November rebalance they were removed. Let me just make a couple of comments about what the total picture looks like, and then we'll come back and Lynn and I will actually go through each of these lines for you if you like. Because, as I mentioned on Monday, because of the high concentration of general funds in the mental health and alcohol and drug budget, and because so much of those budgets are constrained by either statutory obligations or by the rules under which the health plan operates, we were forced, I think, to cut substantial, flexible community mental health services in a way that will make it very difficult, I think, for community mental health programs to sustain their continuing operations in communities. So, for example, the mental health crisis system, which is a service element with a separate set of administrative rules, is kind of like the mental health fire department. After the November rebalance plan, we were forced to reduce that program, but because of the way the changes in the rebalance affected the 5,100 reductions, we had to come back and basically close the program effective February 1. That will mean a serious reduction in access for people and will force, I think, many more people into 911 and potentially into the other basic first responding systems in communities. In alcohol and drug treatment, the combination of three reductions has converged to compromise that program. The first is that in the removal of the CD benefit from the OHP standard program, many of the outpatient providers are telling us that about 60% of their revenue comes from that population. That those are adults who qualify solely based on income, basically, and they tend to be those who are coming to the program in their early 20s and working out their problems with alcohol and other drugs, as well as about 40% of the people who are in the methadone program, and we've already seen a couple of the methadone clinics close in anticipation. This reduction came on top of a change that was made because we have exhausted the Intoxicated Driver Fund, which in the last session was redirected and backfilled. The Intoxicated Driver Fund was paid by people who were convicted of driving under the influence. They paid a fine that was put in a separate account, and that account was used to pay for treatment for people who are going through mandated therapy. When that fund runs out, those people are forced into the same outpatient programs that everyone else is. And then two serious cuts in the outpatient alcohol and drug program have reduced access there. So you have a large number of people converging on a very much smaller door in community alcohol and drug programs. In some cases, these programs are delivered directly by counties, and in some cases, they're delivered by subcontract agencies. And at least in one case, we contract directly for those services. The elimination of the medically needy program, this is an extraordinary program for people who have incomes above the level at which they qualify. About half those people, I'm told, are in the program because of the cost of their psychiatric drugs, antipsychotic and antidepressant drugs. Finally, the elimination of drugs for the OHP standard population for those people who do qualify will also mean that those who need mental health drugs will have real difficulty getting them. They are very expensive. And finally, we have in children's mental health a cut of about 40% of the capacity in the day treatment program for children. These programs have been built in every community over more than two decades, and I think you mentioned some confusion about where these were located on Monday. And in fact, over the years, the DARTS programs have gone back and forth between child welfare and mental health. Some years ago, probably five sessions ago, the legislature set targets for us at about 60% of the slots, the capacity funded with Medicaid and 40% non-Medicaid. I want to point out that school districts bear a significant burden here. There are many more kids who need these kinds of services, and school districts are financing them separately. The effect of this cut will be to throw those costs back into public education. It's $1.7 million for this biennium. It leaves about 60% of the capacity remaining. And finally, also related to schools, is our provision of funding for school-based health centers. There are 44 of those centers around the state. 20 of them receive some general fund support. The reduction of this support will reduce our contribution to zero, and I'm told that perhaps as many as 10 to 12 school-based health centers may close. One mitigating factor is that school-based health centers can raise other revenue. They can bill insurance. They can participate in the Medicaid program. There are a number of ways they can raise other revenue. Schools can invest in them directly. Currently, there are about 90,000 health visits per year in school-based health centers across the state.
Yeah, we had mentioned, I think, Monday about the fact that you zero that out and you zero the administration, and so certification becomes an issue. So
that's correct.
I think that's something you need to address probably in the short term, as to how we can deal with that to allow them to still be viable for access to other funds. So,
Mr. Chair, as you've heard in other parts of the department, there is a reduction in access to what we would think of as safety net services here. Community mental health centers have been a safety net in the mental health arena. We have a safety net in alcohol and drug for people who have no other sponsorship. We have school-based health centers, which are in effect primary care for adolescents who won't or can't go elsewhere, and that is a frightening prospect, that at the same time that benefits are probably going to be constrained, and that's the sense I have from listening and the work we've been doing. As you reduce sponsorship or benefits, the safety net needs to grow, not shrink, and that's the dilemma, I think, facing us in human services today. With that, if you like, we can walk through each one of these lines. Would you?
Okay. Yeah.
I mentioned that the item 3 for January 1st is the reduction of funding for certain community-based treatment for children and adolescents. This was added to the budget in 2001 in anticipation of issues relating to the Olmstead federal decision, which in effect says that people have the right to the least restrictive setting for treatment. Our system is heavily dependent on residential services. This was to expand other kinds of community access. And there is an intense discussion going on now about what children are entitled to and future adjustments need to be made. But since these dollars had not been expended, we felt that they were in the front of the line for reduction. The November rebalance postponed the opening of a state hospital ward for forensic patients, primarily in response to a decision in federal district court requiring that we admit patients awaiting treatment until they're fit to proceed with trial. We have been admitting patients under that timeline, but during the fall, the increase in the number of patients slowed down, and we postponed that ward until April 1. Later in this agenda, or in the schedule, you'll see that we're postponing that ward until the next biennium. We have then two reductions in the Office of Medical Assistance Programs. I'm sorry, here you go.
That's fine. Okay. We didn't work out how we were going to go through these. Sorry about that for the confusion. The first item for the Office of Medical Assistance Programs is item 5. We did implement it on January 1st, a voluntary co-payment system for Medicaid clients with some exceptions for prescription drugs and for ambulatory services, meaning things like office visits. This was a directive coming out of the 2001 legislative session. The co-pays are called nominal under Medicaid regulations, or those allowed for generic drugs. It's $2 per prescription. For brand name drugs, it's $3 per prescription. Office visits, mental health visits, those types of services are $3 per visit or per day. And that was implemented on the 1st of January, and so far, you know, we've anecdotally heard that for the most part, because they are voluntary, if a client doesn't pay, the provider still has to provide the service, that clients are able to pay for those co-pays, and that isn't creating an access problem at this point.
Linda Morris Anderson.
That's interesting, because I hope that over time we can track, is someone tracking, because we want to take a look at how much loss is going to go to our pharmacists, et cetera, if they don't. But is there a tracking mechanism?
Mr. Chair, Representative Monis Anderson, there is not a direct tracking mechanism, because the provider does not indicate on the claim whether or not they received that payment. But it would be possible. We make a deduction to the payment regardless of whether or not the payment we make to the pharmacy, regardless of whether or not the pharmacy collects it. And the pharmacy doesn't indicate whether or not they have collected it on the claim, although it may be possible to do some small survey work to get at that question.
Mr. Chair, follow-up. So what you're saying is that we have no way of knowing the sort of losses sort of system-wide that pharmacies are taking from folks not paying for the copays.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dalto, that is correct, without doing some survey information. And so far all we have is some anecdotal information from pharmacies, a couple of pharmacies. Item number six is a reduction in the benefits cover for all 440,000 Oregon Health Plan participants. It eliminates eight lines on the prioritized list of health services. This was the original mechanism to contain costs under the Oregon Health Plan, and we've had limited success with the federal government in terms of being able to make that movement. But the Bush administration indicated that they were open to this, and they did approve this line movement. It went into effect January 1st. The services that were eliminated were treatment for things like acne, skin rashes, hives. Those things that have been identified by the Health Services Commission as the least important within the benefit package.
I think it's my turn again.
Yeah, I think so.
Moving to February, items beginning with item 7, those two items, 7 and 8, are reductions of unspent funds that were to be used to enhance our effort in reducing health disparities through the work of the Office of Multicultural Health, which is in health services. Health disparities are a significant problem. There is a governor's task force on racial and ethnic health that is tracking things like asthma, diabetes, lead toxicity, and so forth. These funds were intended to enhance our data collection efforts and to do some community planning, and that will be postponed. Item 9 is the school-based health clinic reduction of $500,000. It is reflected in the governor's balanced budget at $2.6 million in reduction for next biennium. Item 10 reduces the support for contracted perinatal and prenatal programs. While this program is mostly federally funded, there was some general fund available for reduction, and this is a significant program and a small but significant reduction in access. Those services are delivered through local health departments. Item 11 reduces a state support for communicable disease control. We make those payments on a per capita basis at about 65 cents per capita per year. This is a reduction of it's a reduction of about 7% in the total program effort. 93% of the resources will remain in the next biennium for communicable disease. Some people have said, well, this cut is not serious because there's been an infusion of new money from the Bioterrorism Preparedness Program, but in many ways our communicable disease effort is more compromised by bioterrorism preparedness than enhanced, because the resources that are required to, for example, ramp up for smallpox, anthrax, and so forth are not sufficient to fund all of the work that's being done by county programs. On the positive side, those resources have added about 53 positions across the state in local health departments. Item 12, there was again unspent revenue for funding the Council on Healthcare Interpreters. Access to care often depends on culturally appropriate and language appropriate access. That will be postponed. Item 13, in mental health, during the last session, in response to the mental health alignment work group proposal, $6.5 million for services and $1 million for planning was added to the mental health budget. This reduces the remaining amount of funds that weren't cut earlier in the process by earlier special sessions or rebalance plans. Item 14 is the reduction, the first reduction in mental health crisis services as a result of the December revenue forecast, $872,000. And you'll see later on that the balance of our mental health crisis program in the communities is eliminated as a result of 5,100. For a number of years, we have sponsored an Office of Consumer Technical Assistance. These are general funds that were used a decade ago to support consumer-operated services in the metropolitan area, and were expanded to, in the mid-90s, to develop consumer-operated or consumer advocacy groups statewide. These are people who have serious mental illness, who are often disabled by their mental illness, represent people coming out of state hospitals and so forth. That represents 100% of the program. We will not contract with them again if this because of this reduction. This reduction is not dependent on 5,100. It is revenue forecast related. Sorry?
Can I just clarify, sir? You're saying that there's no state money that's going into that Office of Consumer Technical Assistance?
As a result of this cut, that's right, Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, there will not be a program for consumer technical assistance.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Dalton.
Dr. Cass, could you elaborate on the services that the Office of Consumer Technical Assistance provides?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dalto, let me say first of all that I'm not a physician, so I appreciate the promotion, but it often happens, actually. People want to believe that those of us who are operating these programs are medically trained, but in fact, most of what we do in mental health work is actually not the healthcare part of the program. It's finding housing and work and providing street-level supports, case management, and social work. In fact, what the Office of Consumer Technical Assistance has done is first to give consumers a voice in planning statewide and in Salem for what the mental health system should be doing and how it should be operating. So it's an advocacy group. I say advocacy in contrast to lobbying, which is not what our contract explicitly does not fund lobbying. Secondly, they've had an account for seed money for local consumer groups to get together. This is not unlike support groups that you see for other kinds of illnesses in local hospitals and community centers. They also are contracted with us. All of these dollars flow on the specific contract to assist us in evaluating our programs and participate in site visits and that kind of thing. Where am I?
16.
Under the statutory language that limits the state's expenditures to funds available, we are forced to terminate our contracts with 17 hospitals that provide extended care after a person has completed acute treatment. So this is a little complicated, but if, for example, somebody has an acute episode of depression and they go to the hospital and it's determined that they subsequently need another service like a state hospital bed or a residential program, but there is not a bed available. Once they're certified, that acute bed is no longer financed through acute care funds. It becomes financed under a different contract. And in effect, we run out of money for extended care in local community hospitals. In fact, it is an expensive way to provide extended care, since acute care is $800 or $900 a day, and we can do extended care for very, very much less than that.
On that issue, when the monies are given to the counties, could you explain a little bit? Can counties then say, okay, I want to provide community-based services to mental health, but I'm going to be running out of money to pay for the acute care? I mean, do they have that discretion, or does directives come from DHS as to the allotment of the money?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mona Sanderson, we finance these kinds of services through two vehicles. One is an agreement with the counties that addresses the needs of people who aren't eligible for the health plan, and the other are capitated dollars that flow to mental health organizations who also work directly with the counties, and in some cases our counties, to accept some risk for acute care. In the latter, the mental health organization is responsible and obligated to finance that acute care, and therefore has a very strong incentive to find alternatives to acute care and to provide early intervention. Those services are governed by our mental health organization agreement and under the conditions that we've developed through the Oregon Health Plan and the mental health part of the Oregon Health Plan. The other dollars in some cases flow through counties on a regional basis. In some cases we contract directly with a local hospital for acute care, and we actually are buying a specific number of beds. Often we are actually receiving services in more beds than we're paying for because of the obligations hospitals have under certain federal requirements. I think your question was, do the county mental health programs have some discretion? Each of our accounts is governed by a separate administrative rule. There is in the statute some flexibility so that money can be moved around, but beyond 10% of the value of a service, then the state has to participate. But we have never been reluctant to work with a community mental health program that wanted to develop alternatives to expensive inpatient care, and we try to do that. Last year, for example, we developed a post-acute intensive program in Gresham, operated by a company called Telecare out of California. It's been a very successful program. Saved the state a lot of money. Item 17. A shocking fact is that about over 90% of people with serious mental illness are unemployed. It's one area where we need to do more in terms of rehabilitation and employment supports. We started a supported employment program about 10 years ago with advocacy from the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill and the Mental Health Association. This will remove most of the funded services in that area. You remember on Monday we talked about things that were and weren't related to public safety. These are very important programs for people who are trying to recover from mental illness, but they're less related to public safety than other things, and they were one of the first items on the cut list. Item 18 is the reduction in psychiatric daycare programs for about 164 kids. This is about 40% of their contracted capacity. I've forgotten the total number of contracts we have, but there are day treatment programs in many counties across the state, from the metropolitan area to Klamath Falls and east to the Grand. Number 19 eliminates funding for community mental health services for about 10,000 non-Medicaid eligible individuals. This is outpatient care for adults. The next item is the one.
Representative Balto.
Mr. Cass, I have a question on line 18. What happens to the children in the slots at the psychiatric daycare treatment facilities when they're eliminated from those programs?
Mr. Chairman, I think you're likely to hear testimony about this from the day treatment providers, the organization of treatment centers. But from my perspective, we're forcing these children back into the education system. Schools, if they have the resources, can pay for those slots, and in some cases do. More likely, they'll have to find other ways to accommodate their special needs to keep them in school and get them educated.
Yeah. On the 164 slots, are those beds? Are those programs?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, these are not residential programs, although they're still referred to under the DARTS designation because years ago we developed a set of rules that span children's intensive mental health care. But these are basically freestanding day centers. The children come there. They receive an education there that's funded separately from the treatment capacity, and they go home at night. So they're not residential.
That would appear then that it's about a $10,000 per slot per program. Is that for this 6 month period?
Well, I'm at a loss to calculate that, but we pay in the neighborhood of $115 to $140 a day for those services. So, the difference is whether they're matched or unmatched. Some of these 164 children would be Medicaid eligible, and some would not. And so, the amount we pay out of general funds varies according to.
Okay, for this half year.
That's correct. It's for 5 months.
Representative Dalto.
Just a follow up. So. Then if these children are cut from the psychiatric daycare treatment slot and they don't have an alternative available to them within their local school system, they're on their own. That's what you're saying.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dalto.
I understood you to say that they have to look for alternatives.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dalto, I think that's correct, although the schools have an obligation to educate children with special needs, and in some cases that this is a... in effect, a cost shift back to education. I mean, I want to be honest about what it is. I mean, the way we operate these programs is kind of a cooperation between education and human services. We talked on Monday about the 122 beds in adult residential mental health treatment. These are three large congregate care centers, two in Portland, or actually one in Portland, one in Gresham, and one in Enterprise. I have made a commitment on Monday to provide a written summary of the steps we're taking to mitigate these reductions. In two of the three congregate care centers, we're working with the managers of those to change the way they're financed so that we can get them participating in the Medicaid program. And using vacant slots or beds in other program elements to keep them from becoming homeless. And I will provide that written description to you, Mr. Chairman, and to Representative Monis Anderson, who raised the question. As you know, we're facing a litigation here, and we have agreed to, through our the Attorney General, to postpone the implementation of this reduction until April 15th while we work with the litigants to address the what will happen to these programs. I think we should have an intermission now. There's so many mental health reductions. It's like a long movie. Item 21, this is the child and adolescent part of the outpatient program that's being reduced. It's $500,000 for 6 months, and we anticipate that it's about 3,700 children who are affected. This cut rolls up to a full biennium savings in the next in the governor's balanced budget. Item 22 is additional unspent money for increasing community-based services for children and adolescents. We began a process 2 to 3 years ago to reduce our reliance on the state hospital, expand residential and other intensive services. There's a rather lengthy budget note that has been incorporated the last three sessions directing us to move in this direction. These funds were unspent and are designated for reduction. Item 23 is the balance of our crisis response system. It would completely eliminate those services. If Measure 28 passes, and this cut was not necessary, then the reduction described earlier related to the revenue forecast would still be in effect. Item 24 reduces administrative fees paid to mental health organizations. This is an Oregon Health Plan feature. As a result of the actuarial analysis, and maybe you can help me with this, fees were raised in the last session from 6% of the fully capitated premium payment to 8%. For parity, those were also increased for the mental health organizations. But there was no actuarial basis for doing that. It was fair, I guess you'd say. We would roll this back to 6%.
Mr. Chair. Fair as we chose to define it at that point in time. So, yeah, that's fair.
Mr. Chairman, If I go back to 23 for a minute, it says completely eliminate 24-hour, 7-day mental health crisis response in all counties. I'm not sure what that means. Does that mean that when the police pick somebody up that's mentally ill, then there'll be no place for them to take them? Or?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barker, what this means is that if you are a person with a psychiatric emergency, you would call 911 or go to the emergency department of your local hospital. There wouldn't be a mental health program to respond. Typically, people who go to the emergency room or people who are picked up by the police, a subsequent contact is made with on-call community mental health, 24-hour access. That service can't be afforded any longer under these reductions.
Okay, thank you.
It's like closing the fire department in this funny sort of way.
Would that then be like the Marion County Psychiatric Crisis Center here in Salem?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dalto, I think you're talking about the program that's adjacent to the hospital that's run by Northwest Human Services, and I think, yes, a good deal of their funding does come from the service element.
Okay, well,
but not all of it. There are still other sources of revenue for that.
Thank you.
This, let me point out, Mr. Chair, that this is a kind of public utility. There are still other either health insurance or the Oregon Health Plan revenues, which may support crisis response. But once the foundation is eroded, I think it would be very difficult to continue those services. We have a small consulting contract with Oregon Health Sciences University Department of Psychiatry. They've been working with us since the 1970s to continuously bring new knowledge, and they also participate in our licensing site visit process. This item 25 would eliminate that contract. The contract, by the way, it shows up in our administrative budget, not in services. Item 26 is the closure of the Transitional Living Center ward at Oregon State Hospital. Most of our forensic program is inside of a secure perimeter. We have a small cottage program, about 26 beds, that's outside the perimeter and helps patients prepare for community placement. In fact, to close a ward like this, pardon me, we don't open and close wards overnight. And we started working on this in December. And in fact, the Transitional Living Center ward will close at the end of the month. And I think virtually all of the patients have either been placed in the community or moved back into the main house at Oregon State Hospital. And adjustments have been made in the hospital to accommodate them without increasing the capacity of the hospital. So where a month ago we had probably were running our forensic program within 3 or 4 beds of our budgeted capacity, the superintendent tells me that we expect to be about 20 beds over our budgeted census on February 1. So we will be running for 5 months, we'll be running a crowded institution. And there are some risks with that, but we've done that in the past, and I think we'll be able to manage that. And we would certainly be willing to keep you informed of any developments in the hospital as a result. 27 reduces funding for outpatient alcohol and drug treatment. I mentioned earlier that that there's a converging of 3 different reductions on alcohol and drug treatment that's going to make it very difficult for people to get the care they need. We regard alcohol and drug treatment programs as public safety programs, particularly for people who have been convicted of driving under the influence, since the consequences of not treating those individuals is grave. Item 28, reduce non-Medicaid adult residential alcohol and drug treatment capacity by 115 beds. Many people require some kind of a respite from their ordinary environment in order to achieve sobriety and get on the road to recovery. And this will reduce the capacity by about 20%. And fortunately, we moved to the Office of Medical Assistance.
Item 29. Is the implementation of Oregon Health Plan 2, which came out of House Bill 2519, passed during the last legislative session. And about 1/4 of our Oregon Health Plan clients, 110,000 clients,
are impacted by OHP2. These clients are clients who have income below the federal poverty level and wouldn't otherwise qualify for our traditional Medicaid program if we didn't have the Oregon Health Plan. The changes that are going into effect that had originally been envisioned as we were moving forward with the program on February 1 is clients will move to a different benefit package, a lesser benefit package than what they have today. Its value is about 78% of the value of services provided today to this client group. There will be no coverage for routine vision care, including eyeglasses. There will be no non-emergency transportation. That was a mistake there. No medical equipment, things like hospital beds, wheelchairs. There's a reduced dental benefit that clients in this program will have. And by the way, these are adults, ages 19 through 64. That reduced dental benefit, for example, it has a $500 limit in services per 6 months. There are mandatory copayments. These are copayments that are more like commercial insurance, and a client, a provider can refuse to provide service if the individual does not make that copayment. Indeed, this program is much more like one that you would see under a commercial insurance program. There are also premium requirements for these clients. We have some of those in today's Oregon Health Plan program, but the amount of premiums in some cases is increased, and there's strengthened rules in terms of non-payment of premiums, basically about a 60-day grace period, and if the premiums are not brought up to date, someone would be disenrolled from the program and not able to come back in for a six-month period. Item 30 is another component of the startup of OHP2. New applicants coming into the program will only be able to come into the program if they have been uninsured for 6 months. Today, you could have insurance coverage and still come into the program. So this is focused on those individuals who don't have other insurance available. Item 31, as a part of the original Oregon Health Plan and the actions taken by the May 1, 2002 Emergency Board, we had envisioned starting up the program with an expansion in terms of who would be eligible for the program. Today, adults below 100% of the federal poverty level qualify for the program, and we had intended to expand to 110% of the federal poverty level on February 1. However, the November Emergency Board or rebalance delayed that expansion to July 1. We are still going to have an expansion in the program on February 1. That's not listed here. We are expanding coverage to pregnant women and children under the age of 19 from 170% of the poverty level to 185% of the poverty level.
And that expansion is about how many sold?
About 1,500 people. Item 32 begins House Bill 5100 cut. The seniors and people with disability portion of our department had identified on Monday the elimination of long-term care services to clients in their system with in the priority levels 15 through 17. That was about, in terms of the long-term care group, about 4,200 long-term care clients. And two-thirds of those clients will lose their Oregon Health Plan medical wraparound, OHP Plus benefit package, today's benefit package, that full range of medical coverage available through OHP. Another group that's listed here is that about a third will still qualify for OHP Plus because their incomes will be low enough to meet the eligibility criteria under the long-term care system. We think about 300, that's 7-8% of the individuals, will qualify for Oregon Health Plan standard benefit package. So they will still have
some benefits through the Medicaid program, but not as full a benefit, rich a benefit package. And then about half of the individuals will still get help from the Medicaid program to pay for their Medicare premiums, their Part D premiums. So there's some assistance there for those individuals. This is tied to the ballot measure 28. Item 33 is also tied to ballot measure 28, and this is elimination of the medically needy program. This would impact about 8,000 clients. This program provides benefits to individuals who have an income that's a little bit higher than what would qualify for the traditional categorical Medicaid programs. They have a limited benefit package, prescription drugs, mental health and addiction services, and transportation to access those services. About three-fourths of the clients participating in this program have Medicare coverage, and so a primary need here is the drug coverage that isn't provided in the Medicare program. Once again, tied to ballot measure 28. Item 34.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, sir. Representative Dalton.
On item 33, the medically needy program, what are the clients supposed to do if they're not able to sort of fall into another program?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dalton, there are very limited options available to clients. There are some pharmaceutical manufacturers who provide, a compassionate care program for some low-income individuals, and we have available some of the websites and resources in terms of how someone can work with their doctor to try and get signed up for that program. Senator Walker has worked with drug manufacturers to set up a kind of a drug fair in the Eugene-Springfield area, bringing the manufacturers together with seniors with the potential that they can get signed up for some of those programs. There are also, for those who do not have Medicare, there are some other options. Potentially, there's the high-risk pool, the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool. There's the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program. Also, that would be for someone who does not have Medicare coverage. The department is starting a new program in February that will be phased in over 4 months, called the Senior Prescription Drug Assistance Program. Although, and this is for seniors, obviously most of whom would have Medicare coverage, and that's a program that would allow seniors who qualify to purchase drugs at Medicaid rates and from participating pharmacies. And we're getting quite a bit of interest from pharmacies to participate in that program. And it's really the pharmacies that subsidize that discount to seniors. And we have a mail order vendor who's agreed to participate in that program. Someone does have has to be a requirement that they have to be uninsured for 6 months, though, before they come into that program.
Mr. Chair, follow up.
Yes.
I guess my concern is I met with an individual from my district yesterday who has a list of, I think maybe 21 or 23 prescriptions that that person takes, and is really, really frightened about the prospect mm-hmm. of losing that coverage. And I was at a loss as to what to tell that individual yesterday, and I continue to be at a loss even after that explanation you just gave. So, I mean, it's her medications are probably $2,000 a month. Her copays, the copays that she makes, are almost out of reach. For the monthly budget of that individual, so I'm extremely concerned about
that. Mr. Chairman, there is in addition, Representative Dalto, to the list that Lynn gave you, the last two sessions of the legislature have added to the mental health programs, I think, $2.5 to $3 million in drug support. I can't tell you this morning which counties those are in. We had a competitive process for allocating them because they weren't sufficient for statewide application. But that's potentially a mitigating factor, but it's not a lot of money when you think about the cost of psychiatric drugs, which I think are about half the medically needy program.
I would add to that that, which I have forgotten to mention, is there is about $500,000 that's been identified as a set-aside for potentially supporting some antipsychotic medications. And staff are working on how that smaller amount of money might be utilized, potentially with a voucher system through community mental health programs. And the other comment I would make related, should ballot measure 28 pass and this program not go away, for the client with copays that seem out of range because of the number of prescriptions, the pharmacy mail order program does not have copays, so someone who has maintenance drugs could utilize that. Moving on to item 34. This is elimination of payment for Medicare premiums, Part B premiums, or a portion of that, for about 2,500 people with incomes between 120 and 175% of the poverty level. Today, this is a program that has been 100% funded by the federal government. The federal government has said that funding for that program will end in March, and so this February date is too early. They've extended their funding and may continue to extend their funding. It had been our intent to continue to pay those premiums with general fund when that program ended. However, now in response to House Bill 5100, we put that on the reduction list. There is still a potential that the federal government will continue to extend that program, but at this time they have not. Item 35 is funding to safety net clinics. There was a pool of money identified in the 2001 legislative session that was to go to safety net clinics in the state. I think that originally was maybe $2.1 or $2.2 million. And that in each of the special, not each of the special sessions, but two other times, portions of that pot of money have been taken to address the budget shortfall. This is the last piece of money that was in that fund. None of the money has gone to the safety net clinics.
These are the non-federal, right?
It's a combination of the non-federal, federally qualified health centers and other safety net clinics. It was intended for use for people who do not have coverage or are underserved in some way. And, of course, at a time when the safety net clinic is needed more than ever as we reduce coverage.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
Would it be appropriate at some point to have an overview for the benefit of at least the newer members of the system of safety net clinics in Oregon?
I would suggest that might be something that the audit committee will be doing. You were here when we started. Our committee's invited to sit in with the audit starting at 3, and we're going to be doing some kind of specific overviews of categories. So I have a feeling that will fit into that book of business.
If you turn to page 10, and Lynn, I think, is going to take us through the mental health aspects of the Oregon Health Plan reductions associated with the November rebalance and the forecast. Items 2 and 3 on page 10.
I'll incorporate items 2 and 3 into the OMAP identified items below. Basically, item 5, the November rebalance, the November Emergency Board, decided to use some of that flexibility that was afforded to us by the OHP2 waivers to further reduce the benefits that would be available to the 110,000 clients who are in the OHP standard benefit package. So we'll start the program February 1 with the benefits originally intended, and on March 1, we will reduce those benefits. And the benefits that will be reduced, well, eliminated, will be the outpatient mental health services. That's number 2 on this page. And then on number 5, the remainder of the dental benefits, medical supplies, that includes oxygen, diabetic supplies, the full range of medical supplies, and outpatient chemical dependency services.
And as Barry had mentioned before, over half of the Oregon Health Plan chemical dependency budget is expended on this population, this 110,000 individuals. Item six, well, let me skip item six for just a moment so I can pick up item three which and item seven, which are tied together. Another change that we will implement on March 1, which comes in response to the December revenue forecast, is changing the beginning date of eligibility for Oregon Health Plan standard clients. Today, an individual who applies for the program, once found eligible, is eligible retroactively back to the date they requested coverage under the health plan. And that's used quite frequently by hospitals and safety net clinics in terms of when someone comes in the door, helping that individual establish that as their date of request so that the services would ultimately be paid for under the program. What this will do is move that beginning date of eligibility out to the first of the month following eligibility determination. So it'll be a future effective date of eligibility. Stepping back to number six, this is a reduction in payments to DRG hospitals. DRG hospitals are hospitals of 50 beds or more, the larger hospitals in the state. There are about, I think, 26 DRG hospitals. And there are three components to this reduction. It's not worded quite accurately. There are payments made to those hospitals for hospital stays that are of excessive cost beyond what is normal for a given diagnosis and treatment. And those are called outlier payments. Those outlier payments will be eliminated except for children under the age of one served in a disproportionate share hospital, a hospital that serves a disproportionate number of low-income individuals. That would be a hospital like Oregon Health Sciences University.
And is this going back to reductions that were proposed in the November e-board and were changed, and now you're going back to them again?
Mr. Chair, that is correct. We have previously proposed this as a reduction on a list. Given the new increased revenue shortfall, it has resurfaced back on our list. The other two items in the single sentence down there, reduce inpatient and outpatient reimbursement rates. This is similar to what was previously proposed, but not quite as significant. It would be a reduction of 12% to outpatient reimbursement and also a reduction of 12% to inpatient reimbursement for these DRG hospitals. Moving on to page 11.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair. Lynn, could you go back to item number 5 on page 10? And just a clarification, I think I heard you say that that the OHP standard benefits, that package, not just this package, but the standard population accounts for over 50% of the OHP costs. I didn't think that was right, and maybe no. I just misheard.
Mr. Chair, Representative Westland, it accounts for over 50% of the alcohol and drug treatment costs. They're a disproportionately represented group in those expenditures.
That makes sense. Okay, thank you.
And they're about a fourth of our Medicaid population. I don't know that their overall expenditures are a fourth, but probably in that ballpark.
Okay. Lynn, I'm going to ask you to wrap it up in just a couple minutes because I've got public testimony scheduled for 9:30, and I'd like to hit that relatively close. So.
All right. Item number 8 on page 11 is reducing reimbursement to pharmacies. We currently reimburse at something called average wholesale price minus 14%. This would reduce it to minus 17%. Item number 9 and 10. Which requires statutory change, and the bill may come before your committee here, it's tied to House Bill 5100, would no longer provide cost-based reimbursement to smaller hospitals. Item 11 is the last piece that we can eliminate from the OHP standard benefit package under our current federal waivers. Would eliminate drug coverage for that 110,000 individuals. Item number 12 is a proposal to expand prior authorization of prescription drugs in order to see some efficiencies there. And moving to page 12, I guess.
For April, I've discussed the state hospital delay.
And item number 3 on page 12 is also the companion piece that goes with the seniors and people with disability long-term care cut. This is the medical benefits for those clients who are in levels 10 through 14.
Okay, and committee, we will have opportunity to discuss these last couple pages. As we're moving forward, these are targeted March cuts. I do have one question on item 12 on page 11. Is there legislation in place to do that, or are you doing that by rule?
Mr. Chair, we would do that by under existing statutory authority and by rule.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I believe for those in the public who don't know, there is a sign-up sheet back there, so if you wish to be heard, please sign up. And I'm going to take from the list, as I normally do, those who have come the furthest first. So first up is Kathleen Sullivan and Ruth. I'm not even going to try that. So one of the toughest parts of being a chair is trying to get everybody's names right. And before you get started, for everybody else who may not be familiar with sitting there, we are a very friendly group, and we've all been there, so we know what that's like. So don't worry about it. Just because you're on camera and can be seen by the entire world, is no good. That was supposed to be a joke, kind of.
Yeah.
So, Representative Butler, would you like to join them? Welcome, and you want to lead off, Representative?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Tom Butler from House District 60. The unique issue in House District 60 is that it is so rural. It is the largest House district in the state of Oregon, representing 25% plus of the land mass of the state of Oregon physically. The concerns that we have in rural Oregon are somewhat unique because there is not a great infrastructure to absorb those folks who would be turned out and turned away from systems as a result of the current cuts that are being proposed by the Department of Human Services. And I would just like to say for a moment that I greatly appreciate the chair and the members of the committee hearing the issues and concerns. And as a result of some of these concerns, I've invited the chair of the administrator of the largest facility that I have in House District 60, which is from Ontario, the Presbyterian Nursing Home, Ms. Kathleen Sullivan, to come over and please indicate to the board the issues that we have as we're taking a look at the issues which will, in effect, close the largest facility which I have in my district. And then this morning I've received information from a private company which has a for-profit organization where they receive mostly Medicare and private pay patients, and they're indicating that they will not. They've tried to fill up their extra beds with the domestic violence cases of folks that have domestic violence issues, that where they would be concerned for the welfare for those senior citizens. So, with that, Mr. Chair, I just would express concern that whatever be done relative to the cuts statewide, that we take a look at those areas of the state where we have no shock absorbers, no infrastructure to assimilate those folks who would be cast out and basically put on the street. And with that, I thank you for the opportunity of testifying today, and appreciate Ms. Sullivan's ability to travel over, to fly over, and be here with us at this particular time. Thank you.
And Representative, good luck with your dental appointment.
Thank you very kindly.
Please go ahead.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, thank you so much for the opportunity to be here. I am the administrator at Presbyterian Community Care Center in Ontario, and also I serve as Vice President of Nursing Services for the Oregon Alliance of Senior and Health Services, which is our statewide nonprofit nursing home and housing association.
Kathleen, we need, we have some very silly rules here.
Oh.
And one of them is that everybody that testifies has to identify themselves by name for the record.
Okay. So. I am Kathleen Sullivan. Is that enough?
That's good enough.
Good. Okay. I'm taking the opportunity today to be here and to discuss the effects of the proposed rate cuts, particularly if ballot measure 28 fails, on our facility, but also on the facilities of Eastern Oregon and the rural areas in this state. The nursing homes in this state, particularly in the rural areas, are very unique to their communities. There are all kinds of different organizations. We are a freestanding nonprofit. Vail, the town closest to us, is a small freestanding nursing home, which is converting some of its beds to an assisted living. We have nursing homes that also are associated with hospitals in the area. One thing that we do have in common is that particularly the rural Eastern Oregon facilities are 75% Medicaid. And that means that naturally most of our revenues come from Medicaid. And we are looking, particularly if ballot measure 28 fails, at a $17.73 per day reduction in that Medicaid rate. And I'm going to talk dollars, but this is going to translate into people fairly soon. For my facility, which is a 96-bed facility, that translates into about $30,000 a month that we will lose in revenues. Now, that goes on top of the $29 plus that we already lose per day on our Medicaid residents. I look at almost $600,000 a year that I am short on my budget, and I haven't got to the starting blocks yet. I have to make up for that with our private pay people and with our Medicare people. And the facts of life are, in a facility like mine, a skilled nursing facility, is that we charge the private pay people enough and hopefully make enough revenues on the Medicare people to make up for those losses. And while that has worked fairly well in the past, we just got a Medicare rate reduction that was huge in October. So what I'm looking at is a shortfall now and on our Medicare rates, and putting this Medicaid loss on top of it means we're looking at almost $50,000 a month down starting February 1st if ballot measure 28 fails. And we simply are not going to be around, and it will not take long. We've faced increases in costs like the rest of the healthcare facilities around the country. 3 years ago, my liability insurance was $18,000. Last year, it was $106,000. It reflects what's happening with all the healthcare facilities. And what I'm looking at is the rest of the facilities in Eastern Oregon facing exactly the same problem. And as they say, then we get down to what this translates into, and that's the people that live there. The nearest skilled facility in my area is 75 miles away. It's in the same kind of position that I'm in. And if we close, I don't know how far the people are going to have to travel to find healthcare facilities. And these are people who have worked so hard all their lives. Most of them were taxpayers. They're farmers. They were veterans. We have a gentleman who won the Congressional Medal of Honor in our facility, and he's a Medicaid recipient, and there's not going to be a place for him to live if these cuts go into effect. And that's my story, and I feel very strongly, it's my belief, that that's the story of most of the Eastern Oregon facilities and possibly the rest of the rural facilities in Oregon.
Thank you. Questions? Representative
Mr. Balboa. Chair, so do I understand you to say that you have 25% of your population are subsidizing that other 75%, the Medicaid folks that you're losing money on, even before you have this additional cut?
Yes, sir.
How is that possible? I mean, it must be some of that fuzzy math, I guess. that's a tremendous job that you do.
Thank you.
Just a quick question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. What is your overall budget for the health facilities?
My overall budget is just under $4 million a year.
And for 96 residents?
We average around between 70 and 80 residents.
Other questions?
Mr. Chair?
Representative Westland.
Thank you. You indicated you're getting a Medicare reduction. What
yes,
percent
sir.
Is that, and what's that translate into dollars per day?
I don't have it divided down per day, sir, but we've done a side-by-side since that reduction went into place, and for the last 3 months, we've lost between $10,000 to $17,000 a month, or we've received a lesser rate of $10,000 to $17,000 per month.
For 80 patients?
Yes. We average probably 10 to 15 Medicare patients.
Medicare patients.
$212.
Mr. Chairman? Yes.
Ms. Sullivan, what is the cost for the private patients in your home? Average monthly cost?
Average monthly cost is probably... Again, you know, of course, depending on the acuity of the resident, $3,500. Yes, we're actually one of the lower costs in the state.
No questions. I really want to thank you. I know it was a long way to come, but this is important to you, and it's important to us also.
Mr. Chair, thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you. My name is Ruth Gullius, and I'm the executive director of the Alliance, of which Kathy is a member and on our board. I just wanted to, we very much appreciate your time. I wanted to just really reiterate and underscore what Kathy has said. The cuts that are being proposed to senior programs are severely dismantling our long-term care system. And we are very fearful that it will eliminate it in rural Oregon. Kathy is, as she said, not alone. This is affecting our nursing home members, assisted living, our housing members that have independent, quote-unquote, residents who receive Medicaid services. And what we're hearing across the state, and I have some personal stories for you, is where do these people go when Kathy closes her doors? If the cuts go through, there's a lot of people here today to speak, so I'm not going to take any more of your time. I will submit the personal stories, and the Alliance and our members really look forward to working with you on protecting vital services to our seniors. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Les? Les Bush and Stan Gilbert.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee,
I'm Les Bush. I'm an assistant professor at Oregon Health and Sciences University. I direct their Children's Psychiatric Day Treatment Center, which is part of the psychiatry department. I have with me Stan Gilbert from Klamath Youth Development Center and George Longdon from Family, Friends, and Grants Pass, who's also here as members of the Oregon Association of Treatment Centers. We're here to speak about item 18 on page 3 of your list. A point of clarification, our programs are not daycare. They're psychiatric treatment center. And they're governed by administrative rules that was developed through a rule process in the Department of Human Services. The proper name is Children's Psychiatric Day Treatment. So it is a difference. I have nothing against daycare, but I want to emphasize this is intensive treatment to young children and adolescents, too, who have severe psychiatric diagnoses. Most of them have more than one diagnosis. Often three-quarters of our population, Mr. Gilbert would tell you some more about this, have more than three diagnoses from a psychiatrist defining their difficulty.
Would it be safe to characterize this population as being at risk themselves or others in a very acute way?
Absolutely, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Yes, thank you. I just want to talk briefly about my own program and what's going to happen if this cut's implemented. Then I want to give Stan an opportunity and George an opportunity to briefly fill you in on their perspective from their parts of the state. We currently serve 21 children minimum in our program at the university. 19 of those 21 children have a eligibility code that would make them eligible for Medicaid Title 19 funding to help pay the program's cost. If this goes into effect, I'll be able to serve 12 children in my program maximum. 7 of the Medicaid children who were eligible and we could have claimed federal funds will have to go elsewhere. I don't know where. And the other children we serve will be returned to the community, will be sent out to school districts to try to deal with. That's where they came from in the first place, and they're asking us to help. We have no private contracts with school districts. The parents who come to us come from all over the metropolitan area, and they tell us they've been searching for a program that's appropriate for their children, sometimes for years. The need is real. The pain is incredible. The severity of the problems of the children, of course, as you know from previous testimony that we've given, is very severe. This cut goes deeper than general fund. It goes into those kids who could be Medicaid eligible. We've suggested to the Department of Human Services staff that we would be willing to work with them in a number of ways to try to identify a maximum number that could be eligible for federal funding so we don't have to cut so deeply into this much needed service. And we stand ready to continue to work on that. We have some ideas. We brought some things to the table. We're talking to the people at Revenue Committee about possibilities for other ways of funding this program for children. So we're trying to be proactive in the options that we bring to you. I'd like to turn it over to Stan Gilbert for some information for the committee.
Mr. Chair, committee members, thank you for this opportunity. We've handed out an information packet regarding the DARTS programs, and I'd like to just run through that briefly. The first couple pages
Please identify yourself.
Oh, I'm sorry. My name is Stan Gilbert.
Thank you.
I'm the executive director of the Klamath Youth Development Center, Mr. Chair, and I'm also the executive administrator for the DARTS programs. You'll see a map that shows the current network of psychiatric day treatment programs. It's about 5 or 6, 7 pages into this packet, and it the stars indicate the various programs and how they're distributed throughout the state. We're currently providing services in 25 of Oregon's 36 counties, and our current capacity is about 400 children and adolescents, and we're serving about 550 youth per year. You'll see on the 12th page in a graph that we've prepared that kind of shows where the psychiatric day treatment programs fit into the kids' mental health system of care. You can see that those programs below the dashed line are community-based programs. Those are services that take place in the communities where children live. And the programs above that line are serving kids outside of their home communities. These are institutional settings in which kids have to travel from their home communities to live away from family, friends, school. You can see that the psychiatric day treatment programs are serving a high severity population, as are the other non-community programs listed above that on the graph. I think it's easy to see as you look at this what the alternatives are going to be for kids that are currently in the psychiatric day treatment program. They'll receive no services locally, or if their mental health conditions and behavior deteriorate to a point that they need service, they're going to be cost shifted into a much more expensive level of care higher up on the graph. Our position is that we're dealing with a population that, due to the severity of their mental health condition, really requires treatment. These are children that won't be ignored in their communities. They cannot be. And the alternative is really to push them into a higher cost service. I think further on in the graph, you'll see some basic information about the programs, gender, cultural backgrounds, admitting behavior characteristics. There's also a graph entitled Handicapping Conditions, which I think is of interest because it indicates the number of non-mental health handicapping conditions within our population. Many of our children are coming to us heavily traumatized, developmentally delayed, and they're presenting with a variety of handicapping conditions that also are requiring our attention. Many of these kids are also eligible for other kind of federally mandated services that we're addressing in our day treatment programs. And without psychiatric day treatment, many of these kids aren't going to receive services in these areas as well. Finally, I'd like to draw your attention to the very last page of this handout, which indicates outcomes. Our system was chosen by the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry to be a test site for a new assessment tool that the American Academy developed. It's called the CALLOCUS test. And it stands for the Child and Adolescent Level of Functioning Scale. And you can see that there's a dramatic difference between scores at admission and discharge. What that basically is showing, that kids come to us at a level where day treatment or residential treatment is required in accordance with this test. And they're leaving us with test scores that indicate a need for maintenance services only. When we discharge kids, they're not even scoring at a level where outpatient care is needed. So I think what we're giving you is a system of care that works, it shows good outcomes, it's community-based, and the alternative is a much more expensive level of care. I'll be glad to answer any questions you might have, and I hope this information is useful to you.
Thank you so much. This is valuable information. I don't really have a question, but I do want to make a point in one of your graphs for the dual diagnosis
yes.
population on the admitting. I see that there is almost 30% of those admitted are fetal alcohol.
Fetal alcohol or drug-affected, representing Mona Sanderson.
That is strictly, it's preventable. We know what causes fetal alcohol syndrome. And again, prevention is my, I wish we could prevent those 30% of this population So we need to work on that, too. But thank
I
you.
Agree with you completely, Representative.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Anderson.
Could you tell me what kind of return you're seeing? It's not recidivism, but how many of the children need to return after they've been helped?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, that's an excellent question. You know, our recidivism rates are extremely low, below 5% come back. We haven't exactly worked on that figure, but as the administrator of our database, I can tell you that the number is probably 1 or 2%.
On your dual diagnosis population chart that Representative Montes Anderson referred to, there's a 71.8%. And that's not, there's no figure as to who that is.
Well, Representative, Mr. Chair, I apologize for that. It should indicate that they are presenting without any substance abuse history.
Representative Dalto.
Thank you. Mr. Gilbert, turning your attention to the gender pie chart, I note the male population 73.1%, female 26.9%. Why such a substantial disparity in gender of your clients?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dalto, it's also an excellent question. We admit children into our system on the basis of referral. Our referrals come from schools, mental health services, physicians, courts, juvenile departments, child welfare system, and it is an unfortunate truth that among children, boys tend to be a noisier problem than girls do. One of our priorities as a network is to try to educate schools and others regarding the presence of mental health conditions in girls that go unrecognized. And actually, we've seen over the course of time that the percentage of girls admitted to the system has increased, but we recognize we're still not at a level of parity, and that's something we're working on. It is a system-wide problem that needs to be addressed.
Must be why my car insurance is so high.
Okay.
My name is George Longdon. I'm the Executive Director of Family Friends. We're an agency in Grants Pass. I live and work and manage an agency in Representative Anderson's district. And we operate a 20-child child day treatment program, which is slated to be cut by 9 youngsters as of February 1st. You know, it's been hard to sit in this room this morning and listen to the enormity of these cuts and the numbers of people affected. It makes it a little hard to talk about 9 children. But for these 9 children and their families in my community, these are very important services. I think that all of us in this room know that cuts have to be taken. I think my concern is about the depth of this cut in this particular part of the system. Although you've been told that the cut's about 40%, the actual numbers that I have at this point represent about a 44% cut in my program. And what is significant about this is you begin to cut into infrastructure and cut a program like this so low that there are several programs smaller than mine who I'm fearful that they will be able to survive this cut. And so even when things do turn around and we have an opportunity to bring some things back, some of these programs may have been lost in the meantime. Although I do think my program will survive, I'm going to have to lay about 5 staff off. And as previous speakers have noted here, we provide psychiatric day treatment services. We utilize skilled mental health personnel, which are not always easy to recruit and bring to rural areas. Among those 5 people that I'm going to lay off, a number of them are going to leave. They're not just going to leave my agency. They're not just going to leave Grants Pass. They're going to leave Idaho. Why do I know this? Because 20 years ago, when Oregon went through this, I'm sorry, they're going to leave Oregon. I mentioned Idaho because 20 years ago, when this happened, I was working for Union County Mental Health in LeGrand. My job working in child mental health was eliminated, and I went to Idaho because it was the first place I could find that had a job. We spent about 8 years there until my wife determined that she was tired of living in the wilderness and wanted to return to Oregon and friends and family. So we came back. But the point is that oftentimes when we lose this type of personnel, it's very hard to recruit people back. And I would add to that that we have been blessed in Josephine County. About 18 months ago, we needed to recruit a new psychiatrist because one was leaving the community. Because of a new rule that the Department of Human Services had put out, all of the day treatment programs were required now to have the service of a trained child psychiatrist. Trained child psychiatrists are hard to find in this country. It is one of the most underserved medical subspecialties. A miracle happened in Josephine County. We went out looking for one, and we found two. These are the first two ever to live and work within the boundaries of Josephine County. They came to us because our program was in place, because there is another program called SOASTIC, which provides residential care, and because the local mental health clinic where they're both employed had services that meant that the work they did with children was fully supported by auxiliary personnel. As they watch this these programs be dismantled and cut back, I have to tell you, although neither one of them have said they're leaving, I have concerns about how far can we go before another place with better support of programs attracts them away. Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak with you this morning.
Thank you.
If I might, Mr. Chair, I would just like to add that for many of our communities, these programs represent the only intensive treatment service available. If you look at the map that shows the placement of programs, you'll see that many of these are in outlying rural areas where there's no other alternative. We're talking in my community of really needing to ship kids 300 miles away to a residential institution where family involvement in treatment's really not a realistic expectation, where they're removed from those ties and networks that really support kids that are so valuable to providing good mental health care.
Thank you very much. Just for the audience, if you're tired of standing, Hearing Room C is an overflow room, and for the committee, we have the room till noon. I intend on staying till we've heard all the public testimony. So, next we have Linda Ellis.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, my name is Linda Ellis. I am on Social Security Disability. I happen to be the one that Representative Delco had talked about. My income is $693 a month. My medication runs me over $900 a month. My benefits will stop the first of next month. They will pay my premium on my B for Medicare. I would like to know how somebody like me, and which there's hundreds of them, I realize this, but how are we supposed to survive? If I lived out on the street in a cardboard box, I still could not afford to pay for my medicine. And as you can see, I'm a little upset. I have a question that I'd like to ask the human resource, how they came to make these cuts, and to explain to me why people that have used and abused the system for generations, I can tell you of at least a half a dozen that I know personally that have two generations lived and abused the system, that are getting their medications paid for, they're getting their doctors paid for, They have no cuts. At first, they said they had to pay a premium. Now they said, oh, no, you don't have to pay a premium. They never worked, so they didn't have the quarters to get disability Social Security. They got SSI. I'm wondering what makes their life more important than mine and people like me. And I think that's a fair question to ask. And could somebody give me an answer what I am supposed to do the starting of next month? I have proof from my pharmacy what my bills are a month. And not any of them are being mentally. Mine are all physical. I have congestive heart failure. I have diabetes. I've got coronary artery disease. I've got several colon diseases, several stomach diseases, and bone deterioration. Now, if anyone can tell me who would hire me, I would be more than happy to work to make the money that it's going to cost me to pay for my medication. But I don't know anybody that is going to hire me with my physical condition. So please tell me what I can do to stay alive. And I'm not the only one in this situation. There's hundreds of us that are on Social Security disability that have worked and stayed off the system until we were disabled. I raised 3 children on my own because my husband didn't pay me child support and the courts didn't help me. So I held down 2 jobs and raised my children and stayed off the system because I was brought up to say, you don't use this system unless you absolutely need it. I could apply for housing, but there's a lot of families out there that's got children that need that housing more than me. But all I'm asking is, what are they going to do with people like me? Are you just going to give us a sentence to live a miserable life or die? Because that's what it amounts to without the medication. I just would like an answer. And nobody's been able to give me one. What are we supposed to do? Does anybody have an answer for me? Does the human resource have an answer for me?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Dalton.
I'd like to make 2 observations. One, Ms. Ellis, thank you so much for coming and telling your personal story. My observation is this. I guess I'm disappointed that the bulk of the agency personnel that were here for the overview are not here now to listen to at least a portion of the public testimony to hear these stories. I'm disappointed in that. Thank you.
Well, I'm also disappointed in my caseworker of disability because the first thing he told me, it's not my problem. I have no control over it. Go see your senator. Go see your congressman. Go someplace else. I've been up here to this Capitol building 5 different times. Doesn't seem a lot to you guys because you're here every day. But for somebody in my position, I have a hard time getting here. And when I get here, the only person that actually gave me any hope at all was him. And he gave me the opportunity to come and express my feelings, not only for myself, because there's hundreds of people just like me. And we're feeling, I talked to a lady the other day that's in a wheelchair, that's on Social Security disability, worked all her life. Her benefits were cut. She said, why? If somebody that used and abused the system still getting the assistance, and the people that have worked and tried to stay off the system, you work and you think if something happens, then you might have to use that system. Well, that happened to me. I didn't want it to happen to me, but it did. And now I don't know what to do. I do know that when you're on heart medication and stuff like that, if you don't take it, you're going to die. Bottom end, you're going to die sooner than you normally would if you would take the medication. With congestive heart failure, I know my life isn't that long. But what is left, I would like to live at least comfortable and not have to worry about maybe moving out on the street. And that's just the crossroads that I'm at right now, and I need answers.
We don't have answers. Well, let me finish. But that's what we're searching for. That's why we're having this hearing today, is because we are searching for answers.
Well, I did get a list of pharmacy companies with my doctor's help, hopefully, on the 28th. He can try to get some of my medication for me. But I can't see any pharmacy taking the responsibility of almost $1,000 a month medical insurance for one person, let alone hundreds like there's going to be. And some of us can't even afford the copayment that we've got this month. When you have as many medications as I do, and you're living on such a limited income, I get $693 a month. I pay $447 of that towards rent. That's not counting car insurance. That's not counting food. That's not counting anything. That's just my household. So how in the world do they think we're going to survive? Even if I moved out and lived in a cardboard box, I could not afford my medication. And I think somebody should take a closer look at some of the people that are on the system, that has used the system for years and years, and that are capable of going to work because they have a couple of kids or this or that. They get to have it. Or people that's on SSI, that's under Medicaid, that their wages, they never worked long enough to make any quarters, so their income is so low that they get the help. But what about us that did work? That's what's bothering me. There's a lot of us out there that worked every day, raised our kids, and never thought this could happen to us. But it has.
Thank you. Linda, is that...
Linda.
Linda, thank you so much for coming. I just want to echo what the chair had said. As we've been hearing today, we're talking about not hundreds, but thousands
of people who are
going to be in the same position as you. It's one thing to see it on paper. It's one thing to hear the numbers. It's another thing to see a face and hear a person's life story. Thank you so much for coming. We don't have any answers today. I wish we did. I'd like to encourage you to keep on coming. Keep on hammering us and letting us see that there is a person here who is representing thousands and thousands of people in Oregon, and we need to do whatever we can to help these people and not just say there's nothing we can do. We must help you.
Well, I appreciate all of you taking the time to listen to me, and believe me, you have not seen the last of me until I get some answers. I'm sorry, but I do appreciate it, and I'm not here just for myself. There's a lot of people here like that, just like me, that really don't have an answer.
That's on the west one.
Linda, just make sure you and I, are you leaving right now this second, or are you going to stick around for the rest of the public testimony?
I could stay around for a little while.
Well, I'll just see you out in the hall if you've got to leave.
Okay. All right. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much.
Okay. And I'll be talking to you.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you.
Done. Keister and Sherry Folk. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. Okay. Good morning, Chairman Cruz and members of the committee. My name is Don Keister. I'm director of Providence Elder Place, and I'm here this morning on behalf of the frail elderly people in our program, as well as on the behalf of Providence Health System. Providence Health System is the largest health system in the state of Oregon, with hospitals and clinics in the metropolitan area as well as in rural communities around the state, and has one of the largest community and home services program, which Providence Elder Place is a part of. I'm here today to attempt, I'm not sure I can be as poignant as the last person to testify, but I'm here to try and put a face on the people that these human services cuts will affect. So I'd like to do that by talking about briefly about what Providence Elder Place is, and then talk about three specific individuals whose cuts are scheduled to occur April 1st, and those are the people on survivability scores that we heard about earlier this morning, 10 to 14. Providence Elder Place is part of a national program, program of all-inclusive care for the elderly. And it is the only program in the country that fully integrates Medicare and Medicaid financing to provide care to frail elderly and disabled adults over the age of 55. In essence, we are an insurer because we get capitated premiums from Medicare, from Medicaid through senior people with disabilities, as well as the Oregon Health Plan. And our responsibility, and we're at full financial risk for providing all medical, long-term care, and social services to people who choose to enroll in our program. One of the keys to eligibility to enroll in Elder Place is that individuals need to be eligible for nursing facility care in the state of Oregon as defined by the state's criteria, and which is the survivability scale and wherever that falls for our population. We serve over 500 people who have chosen to enroll in our program. With five centers around the Portland area, 89% of the people who have chosen to enroll in Elder Place are Medicaid-eligible people. This program started out of Onlock in San Francisco, and the primary focus was to provide an integrated quality care to publicly financed clients, and also to develop a program that will not cost shift between private pay and Medicaid. So we cannot charge by law the private pay people who choose to enroll with us any more than Medicaid capitation premium that we receive. That's also unique in the country. depending on what cut scenario is talked about in the moment, anywhere from 75 to 250 of the enrolled people in Elder Place could become ineligible for Medicaid, long-term care services, and therefore also ineligible for our program, which also includes the Medicare premium. They would retain their eligibility for Medicare and would have to rely on the fee-for-service approach or enroll in some other Medicare Plus Choice plan, but they would lose their eligibility for Medicaid and also for PACE. These cuts, which, as you know, affect thousands of frail elderly in Oregon, coupled with the provider rate reductions for adult foster homes, residential care facilities, nursing facilities you heard about earlier, and you heard earlier, my sense is that a significant number of those providers will simply go out of business. And these are providers, and this is a home and community-based care system that we have spent, and I'm talking about we collectively in Oregon, have spent over two decades to build to be able to provide this kind of care at much, much less cost for this population than the population in other states. And this would decimate that network of care providers, and it would take a long time to recover, even well beyond when the time Oregon is in full economic recovery. So that we don't forget the individuals, and I'll quit talking about numbers, I do have three persons I would like to talk about, which are real people in our program who are scheduled to lose their benefits effective April 1st. So all three of them are in survivability levels 10 through 14. Mr. F has multiple health issues, including advanced supranuclear palsy and visual misperceptions leading to paranoia, and takes medications for these conditions. He currently is residing in a residential care facility. He's 80 years of age, was born in the Midwest, but spent his adult life in Oregon. And I think it's important to note that we're talking about people who have been in and of our communities and have been contributing members of Oregon, have been citizens of Oregon. As a young man, Mr. F. was drafted into the Army Air Corps, where he worked refueling planes. After the war, he returned to Oregon and worked in the shipyards. He married and had four children. 5 years ago, he moved in with his son when he needed only minimal help with basic life care. Recently, he needed more assistance with personal care, and that's bathing, dressing, walking, and incontinence care, and more than his family could adequately provide. He also needs help with the meal preparation, shopping, housekeeping, medication management, and transportation. He enrolled in another place, and he moved into one of the residential care facilities that we contract with to provide residential services when he enrolled in another place. His son, since then, has had a stroke, and that has really impacted the family's ability to provide care. And we're talking about people who are on the average in another place are early 80s. That means their children, us, are moving into their 60s and are developing their own health care issues and long-term care needs, and really compromises the abilities of families to support this population. There is no alternative for this man in the event he loses his benefits. And the people I'm talking about have monthly incomes of somewhere in the neighborhood of $600 to $1,000 a month. The second one, Mrs. M, she is a breast cancer survivor, has multiple current health issues, including hearing loss and depression, and takes medications for those. She has difficulty remembering and using current information, and so even though she may be able to perform some of her activities of daily living, she has difficulty using current information to actually carry those out. Her judgment is impaired, and she needs assistance with decisions. Mrs. M is a lifelong Oregonian, born in Seaside, now 83 years of age. She married, and she and her husband Louie live in Oregon City, where Louie worked in the mill, and she waited tables part-time. They had two sons. In 1961, the 19-year-old son was killed in a logging accident. Then Louie became ill with cancer and died. After this loss, Mrs. M became a house mother at Portland State University and lived there for 14 years. She moved into residential care because she required assistance with personal care such as bathing, dressing, grooming, medication management, transportation, and meal preparation. Her surviving son assists with her paying bills due to her cognitive impairment. So we are talking about people who to survive, need assistance in the basic activities that we take for granted when we go about living our lives. Mrs. J is 80 years old and lives in a residential care facility. Confusion, vertigo, and tremors are just a few of her health issues, and she takes 7-plus different medications. After finishing the 8th grade, Mrs. J began doing housework and providing child care. In 1942, she began working in the shipyards as a welder's helper. She was married for 25 years, had 3 children, and was then widowed. One daughter died at only 2 days of age, and another daughter died 12 years ago. Mrs. J is dependent on others for all the basic activities of living. Her only surviving daughter is a source of emotional support and assists with financial management. Mrs. J has difficulty remembering and using current information and needs help with decisions. So even if, after these cuts, there were alternative resources, which there aren't, there are a few emergency alternatives, like we heard earlier about pharmacy alternatives, but those are there for people who currently are falling through the cracks, not for thousands of people who all of a sudden will become ineligible for the services. These two people I'm talking about also will lose their eligibility for the Oregon Health Plan. That means they'll lose their eligibility for their pharmacy costs, and those costs range anywhere from, in our program, from $200 a month up to $1,300 a month, depending upon the needs and the medications that people take. And these are just 3 of the thousands of vulnerable Oregonians who in fact, are going to be losing eligibility at the beginning of April. There simply aren't alternatives for these people. considering the thousands of people who will be displaced from residential care facilities, adult foster homes, assisted living facilities, there is not affordable housing in this state to manage or to take the volumes of people we're talking about. And rents, in most cases, would eat up a majority of their income. So they have choices to make between rent, you heard earlier, food, and medications. And whatever choice they make, it's not a good outcome. They will soon deteriorate become more frail, have more medical problems, be swapping other emergency services that are in place for people who currently fall through the cracks, become more frail, all of a sudden become eligible again for long-term care services in the Oregon Health Plan, but at a much higher cost than what we're currently spending. Providence is urging and has been urging for the last 2 months that all of the citizens in Oregon vote yes on Measure 28. Well, we understand that is not a long-term solution. It is, in fact, a short-term solution to keep these critical services in place for the folk who are scheduled for cuts in the next few months. In the long-term, Providence Health System has believed for some time that all of us, hospitals, long-term care providers, insurers, consumers, business, labor, need to collaborate in terms of building a better health system, a better delivery of health care in Oregon, and new financing mechanisms so that we don't go through this cycle. The other thing that happens, even if these people don't, when Measure 28 passes, because it will, and these folk will be restored in the moment, according to what I understand of the governor's technical budget, they won't be eligible in the next biennium. They have gone through emotional turmoil by being notified that they're losing their services. And that takes a toll in terms of people who are anxious about their health care and are dependent on other people for their survival. So every time we go through one of these cycles, these people who are vulnerable citizens get notices that they're not going to get service anymore. Whether that happens or not, it still is a toll, you know, a toll on those folk. This is going to be a difficult undertaking to find long-term solutions, but clearly, as you've heard earlier this morning, this is the work that we have to do to take care of our most vulnerable citizens in Oregon, citizens who have been contributors to where we are today. And so I thoroughly appreciate the opportunity to talk to you this morning. And if you have any questions.
Questions.
Mr. Chair and representatives, my name is Sherry Folk. I'm a director of Goodwill Industries. This is Marie Faisler. She is a program manager down in Salem and works with our clients also in Dallas. Obviously, I'm here to speak about the proposed cuts for the seniors and people with disabilities. I've been with the program for 18 years. I've watched these individuals come out of Fairview, and I have seen so many changes that it breaks my heart to think that they're going to lose their services. I've seen them come from violent behaviors, and the medical issue is also a concern for me. The housing is a concern for me. Vocational is what I'm speaking about now. Again, I work with Goodwill Industries. We have currently been told that 66% of our individuals will lose their supports that enable them to work should Measure 28 fail. And if you know how difficult it is to find work as a, quote, normal individual in this community, can you imagine what it's going to be like if you have mental retardation, cerebral palsy, if you've got multiple disabilities? Several of our clients asked me if I would present their stories. I know you don't have time to hear all of them because we have quite a few stories. But we've just learned yesterday that Marion County is going to cut 21 of the individuals as of February 1st. That's just weeks away. I have to go back and tell the clients today and staff that they're not going to have a job. You can see it's emotional. I've been with these people for years. They are now being productive. They feel good about their job. They know that they are contributing rather than taking from the community. I also represent Southern Oregon Goodwill. Their principals couldn't be here, so they've asked me to confirm that they're facing similar problems as anyone that works with people with disabilities knows. We all are. They serve 99 people, and they've been informed that they're going to have to cut 50 of these slots. And the structure that work brings for these individuals, first of all, one of my clients says, what am I going to do? If I'm not going to be at work, what am I going to do? My answer, all I can answer right now is I guess she'll stay at home. But we know residential is a problem. What am I going to do about my meds? I don't know the answers. I can't answer these questions that they're having. What I do know is that work provides a system, provides a structure, provides a support for these individuals, and we help them with their socialization, with their interactions with coworkers, with their behavior, with their emotional supports. We do incontinence help. We do medication administrations. So we're not just a vocational slot. We are here for the whole person and their whole life. We're also, if you look at it, a respite for their parents. I am a parent of a daughter with disabilities, and I can't tell you how nice it is to have her at work some days when she is threatening suicide and when she's threatening to hurt someone. We parents need respite, too, and vocational settings offer that. The loss of this doesn't just affect the clients. As I said, it also affects our staff, and I'll be having to lay off 4 staff when I go back to the office today. So as more cuts come from my clients, there will be more people out on the street. I don't know what to tell them. I don't know what to do. And as one person spoke earlier, we've got qualified people, and now we're letting them go. I don't know what to do. So one of the stories my clients wanted to tell me was an individual named Mr. D. He came from Fairview, and he was put in Fairview, he said, because he beat up his mom and brother, and he did that all the time because he has a personality disorder, and that's part of his disability. She couldn't handle him. She didn't have a husband. He went to Fairview. He learned that being the biggest and the baddest got him whatever he wanted. So when Fairview downsized and they let Mr. D go, he came out in the community. My first introduction to him was at a 7-Eleven. I was getting a pop, and he comes, grabs me by my neck, moves me over, and says, I want a pop first. Okay, you got it. Now, that individual and I have become very good friends. He came into our program. Not only did he work and learn how to behave and interact with other clients, he learned how to control his anger and his behavior. He's now working out in the community. He's worked in a bakery. He's worked in a welding shop. And now he's working in a retail store. We've given him the opportunity and the skills to take out into the community. So these individuals don't just come to vocational just to be housed. We want to train them in many, many skills, not only vocationally, but also how to live their own life and have a quality of life like you and I do. That's all I have to say.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Michael, Debbie, and Terry. You want the whole group at once here, or? Okay.
Over here.
Representative Cruz, members of the committee, I'm Tim Krall. I'm a director of the Oregon Rehabilitation Association, and these are some of the people who receive services statewide in nonprofits all across the community. Sunrise Enterprises, Spark Enterprises, Albertina Kerr, Garten. You know who these programs are. They're in your communities. And this is page 10 of the cuts you were given this morning, the developmental disabilities. Number one cut on page 10 eliminates non-24-hour care for children and adults, 5,500 people. These are some of the people. They're here because they want to tell you what their jobs mean quickly. We understand you're out of time. And these are people whose parents elected not to send them to the state institutions. They kept them at home. They saved the state hundreds of millions of dollars. And because they kept them at home, now their services are at risk. Had they sent them to Fairview, they would be in 24-hour supports, and they would not be facing a cut. So I'll let them tell you their own story.
Okay.
We need our jobs, please. My name is Deborah. I'm going to live Southeast Salem. I work for All Seasons. So I need my job, please. I like my job, please.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Can I call your name?
Please save our jobs, okay?
Okay.
Please do not cut them, okay?
I'm doing photo and working a group. I live in the house and work in a group home. All the clone behave and work in me and help elect me. And I am in a group home and grab bone in the sky and I'm proud to work.
Okay, thank you.
Good job. Thank
you
very much.
My name's Terry, and I hope the Shangri-La. I hope Shangri-La will help to keep my job here if this is going. Because I hope Measure 28 has to go back down the, you know, up and down and all that bad stuff. And that's it. Okay?
Okay.
Get it?
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Okay. Ruth McGowan. Good morning.
Chair Cruz, committee, my name is Ruth McEwen. I'm here to talk to you about the Medically Needy program. I am one of those people that is being cut. I have been able to be active for some time now in a limited manner because of being able to have the medications that I need. My medications run somewhere around $700 a month. My income is $749 a month. And I'm in a position where if I don't have the medications, they are antibiotics for the systemic lupus, that in a short time I will be in a hospital or I will wind up in a nursing home. But once I get the medications again, then I'm no longer eligible for the nursing home care because I can't take care of myself when I have my medications. Therefore, I will be caught in a cycle. But when I come back out of the hospital or the nursing homes, I will no longer have a place to live because I'm on low-income housing. And with my being vacant from my low-income housing for a period of time, I would lose it. Then I would have to go back to the bottom of the list, on the waiting list, for low-income housing. So I am caught in that same quandary and not knowing for sure where I would be or what's going to happen. So I just came to help put a face to what is happening.
Very much. Questions? Thank you very much for your testimony. Jeremy Gunn.
Mr. Chairman and other members of the committee, I thank you very much for inviting me here today to listen to my cause. My name is Jeremy Gunn. My concerns about cutting the Medically Needy program. This is an emergency crisis for me and thousands of fellow Oregonians who have been kept alive and well due to this Medically Needy program. To cut this program is a death sentence for me since I have HIV. I am HIV positive and rely on this program for my prescription coverage. The drugs have reduced my viral load to an undetectable level, that means I will have less, that means I will have less doctor visits and hopefully no hospitalization. It also means that my doctors and myself can view this disease as manageable, not terminal, and that I might still be alive if there is a cure found. Interrupting or stopping these drugs will cause the virus to mutate and build an immunity to my current drug regime. Switching to other possible drugs does not guarantee the same success in managing this disease. This is a big gamble with my life right now, as it is with thousands of others currently under the program. If you could trade places with anyone who received a two-week notice that as of January 31st you will lose your benefits and coverage, you would feel and know how scared and helpless many people feel right now. I am sure that each of us here knows someone who will be affected by cutting the medically needy program. Maybe a mother, father, son, daughter, grandchild, or a close friend whose life is dependent upon this program for prescriptions, nursing homes, foster care, mental health, counseling, and drug and alcohol intervention, homeless, and others who benefit from this program. I was born and raised in Oregon, and I have supported the state through taxes for over 30 years. My parents did the same for over 50 years. If it is this support that has helped thousands of people before me, unfortunately, I now need my state to help take care of me and to stay alive, help me stay alive and have the best quality of life that I can have. I would gladly trade places with anyone so I could become an active member of society by having a 9-to-5 job and pay taxes that would help support much needed programs for these less fortunate. That's what this country and Oregon is about, caring for one another. But life takes unexpected turns, and I don't have a choice anymore. Having the needy medically program has given me hope that I will be around to watch my grandsons grow up and to be able to give my other daughter and hand in marriage away. It has also given me good health that I am able to attend church weekly, where I find much needed spiritual loving support from my church family. No price tag can be applied to that, to the value for me. To cut this program without regarding the consequences to human life, especially for those people that need it the most, is a devastating thought. It is our responsibility as compassionate and loving and caring human beings to help give the disabled and less fortunate the chance of having the best life possible. And for me, just life itself. We all need and have a right to feel that our lives are important enough to find a way to keep the medically needy program alive. I am pleading with each of you to find a solution to this emergency, a crisis that is affecting so many people. In closing, which is not on my written statement, I would also like to say that I have been told by Senator Verger, I'm not sure if that's the correct pronunciation, that even if Measure 28 passes, the program is dead and gone, and there's no money for that program. Yesterday, I was here in another meeting chaired by Senator Morissette, and there were people testifying that says, yes, if Measure 28 passes, this program will keep this program. But you see, I have two different stories to have to deal with here, so I don't think that I've got the complete answer, the honest answer to that. And I just want to thank you for listening to me. If you have any questions, I'll be glad to answer.
Mr. Chair, didn't the agency say that this line item was attached to Measure 28 in the presentation earlier today? I thought so. So at least the agency is telling us it is attached to Measure 28, just so you have at least my answer.
Yes.
Any other questions?
33.
Any questions? Chairman, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Steve Austin.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, my name is Steve Austin. I am the executive director of Marion Estates. Marion Estates is a senior housing community which has a nursing home, two assisted living facilities, and independent housing options for seniors, as well as I personally own three adult foster homes. I was asked by my association to speak to you today about the impact of what will happen if Measure 28 fails. And I would like to go back to Ms. Sullivan's testimony earlier in the day. She, too, is a nursing home administrator, and she spoke of the effects of the nursing homes on the other side of Oregon. And I would like to second my testimony to hers that the effects on the nursing homes on this side of Oregon would be just as devastating, perhaps even more. She suggested that most nursing homes there had about 25% private to about 75% Medicaid clients. And I would say that the nursing homes on this side of Oregon are probably closer to an 80% Medicaid mix, maybe even 90. Hence, the problem is more compound because we have more Medicaid clients dependent more upon Medicaid dollars. Marion Estates is a little unique as far as nursing homes go. It happens to be the largest nursing home in Oregon. We have 214 beds, hence I'm a little larger than what her facility is. My Medicaid mix is about 65%. I have 35% private. Hence, my margin is a little bit bigger than most nursing homes. So these cuts, even though they're horrible, and I will end up reducing a number of my staff positions and reducing a lot of dollars that we spend in counteracting this, we at least have some cushion to play with. Most nursing homes in Oregon run a very tight balance between their revenue and their outlay. And with these cuts, it's going to reverse that. And I would speculate that if not three-quarters, at least two-thirds of the nursing homes in Oregon would have to go out of business because of these cuts. So the interesting thing about this is that we have many residents, and you've heard testimony today from a lot of different people, but there's many individuals who may lose their Medicaid eligibility, but more importantly, if the organizations or the facilities that they're living at lose their Medicaid rate reimbursement that they're talking about at this point, even the clients who are not going to be losing their Medicaid eligibility themselves may find themselves in a very unique situation to where they no longer can stay where they currently are because the nursing home or assisted living or adult foster home will be going out of business because they no longer have the financing to stay in business. So these impacts are significant throughout the industry. I find that the nursing home In my situation, I have many, many residents who are struggling with this. We've had residents who have received notices that they no longer will have services. I have family members almost on a daily basis talking to me about what are they going to do. When you have residents in a nursing home that are the frailest of the elderly, and they're in their 80s and 90s, their children are in their 60s and 70s, and even though they would support their parents in any way they possibly can, they are not able to care for them in their own homes. They themselves are elderly and not able to do that. So there's a real quandary right now about what are we going to do? What is a family going to do? And if the residents are lucky enough to have family they can fall back on. We're in a unique situation to where what are we going to do as an industry if, first of all, their eligibility runs out? Do we just then turn them out to the street and say, we can no longer provide services for you? That's a very hard thing to do, but yet I cannot provide the services without reimbursement for that. And interestingly enough, what I find is that this doesn't just impact Medicaid clients. This impacts all seniors. My staff, when they take care of these residents, they take care of all of them, and they don't know the difference between Medicaid residents and private pay residents. However, it's my private pay residents who pay a higher premium, okay, for their care that subsidize the Medicaid clients who pay a lesser premium. But my staff, they don't know the difference between that. They give the same care to everybody. So if these cuts happen, which will hamper the care for Medicaid, the same cuts will hamper the care for private pay people because I won't be able to afford as many staff to care for those residents. I'll have fewer staff available to care for their very same needs. So everybody's going to be impacted by this, not just Medicaid residents, but all seniors. Whether it impacts them now directly or impacting them in the future, because most seniors at some point will need the services of a nursing home, whether it be for a quick rehabilitation and back home or long-term care, it will impact them for years to come. So it's a very incredible issue that we have that we're facing right now. So I just want to add my testimony to what others have said. Again, some more detail. In my facility, my cost to care for a resident is about $120 to $125 a day. My current reimbursement from Medicaid is $111 a day, which is below my cost. My private pay individuals will pay anywhere from $130 to $160, depending on their care levels and depending on the room that they have, whether it be semi-private, private, or a three-bedroom. So as you can see, the two of them balance themselves out. The proposed cuts right now would drop my Medicaid rates to $93 a day from $111. That's pretty drastic, nearly $18 a day. That impacts my facility by over $60,000 in a month. To counteract that, I will have to lay off a good number of staff to keep the organization viable. But I'm the lucky one. I don't know how many nursing homes in the state can say this, but my nursing home, with the gap that I have, I can probably make those cuts and keep the business operational. Most nursing homes won't be able to do that. The other nursing homes that I've run, I couldn't say the same thing about. They could not possibly absorb those kind of cuts and stay open. So I'm unique amongst those. My assisted living facilities right now, they've cut out cut as much as they possibly can just to stay at the break-even mark, and they're at 30% Medicaid. Any assisted living that has more than 30% Medicaid probably won't be able to survive this. At an adult foster home level, one resident that you lose, that's one out of five. That's a 20%, loss that you take right there. If you lose two residents in a home, you can't afford it anymore. It's very tight. The industry is a great thing. The services we provide, the continuum, is wonderful because it does great things for an awful lot of people, an awful lot of seniors. But these kinds of cuts that have been proposed will change all of that. I don't know what it's going to do. I don't know how it's possible that we could go through this. The problem that I see and what scares me is that if nothing happens differently, this very thing is going to happen. These cuts will happen. And if Measure 28 fails, I don't know what else to do. But I'm concerned about it. I'm concerned not only for my residents who will lose these services, and many will may end up on the street, but I'm concerned about all the staff who will be losing their jobs. I'll lose a few staff. You multiply that times all the nursing homes in the state, and there's a lot of people going to be without jobs. And that's going to compound the problems with our economy, not help things. Thank you.
Chairman, and just like make a few comments. I'm glad you brought up the difference when the rural-urban issue came up earlier. I'm from the Portland area. I'm from Beaverton, Iowa, and we have those same problems, as you just pointed out. It's not... maybe we have a few more bridges people could live under or something than they do in Ontario, but we're still facing those very severe problems. And I have a mother-in-law who's in assisted in a foster care in Portland, and I might say the care there, you would not be able to tell the difference in her care to somebody on Medicaid. The people in your profession are doing an excellent job helping senior citizens in that transition when they're no longer able to care for themselves. And with they're looking at potentially cutting Medicare eligibility down to an income of $500, $552, which would make her ineligible. At present time, she's spending down her savings to supplement her Social Security. She's fortunate. We have a family that will be in a position to help her, keep her there. But I'm really concerned about the thousands of other people who either don't have family or have family that just will not be able to help them. This is a real problem. I have a mother also who's in a nursing home who's 100, so... I certainly understand some of these issues.
Thank you, and that is compounded. Your family is unique because at least you have family resources that could help out. Many, many don't have that at all.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Karen Gillette. Welcome.
Good morning. Thank you. Chair Cruz and committee members, my name is Karen Gillette. I'm the chair of the Coalition of Local Health Officials and program manager with Lane County Public Health. I just want to make a few comments about the concerns that our coalition has around the public health system in regards to Measure 28 and those identified cuts with communicable disease and perinatal prenatal services. As you know, the role of public health authority is to enforce the public health laws and ensure activities that preserve and promote the health of our population. And two of the essential elements are critical within Measure 5100, epidemiology and control of preventable diseases and the parent-child health services, which we, through that program, our prenatal program assures access for pregnant women to get early prenatal care, addressing some of the concerns that Representative Monis Anderson said earlier, as well as home visits for high-risk families. In the 2001 legislative session, the public health initiative around communicable disease was presented, and we had identified at county levels the public health improvement plans about where the gaps in communicable disease control was and our inability to continue surveillance and investigations. And so those gaps continued. And then, unfortunately, we had September 11th occur, and which sent a whole nother slew, if you will, of work for the public health system, and we were actively involved in citizen calls and questions around anthrax and all types of things. So we continued with those gaps and with September 11th, and then we did receive the bioterrorism health preparedness funds. And those funds are, as you probably know, categorical funds, so they're specific to bioterrorism and preparedness. It does not help us with our concerns around TB, case management, hepatitis, the other things that we deal with on a daily basis. And I can identify especially with our TB caseload and our recent event in August with the E. coli 0157 in Lane County, where we had 83 cases to investigate, that is a surge capacity that was very difficult to handle. The emphasis now with the Center for Disease Control with the bioterrorism dollars is about smallpox, and so that has sent us, our staff, into heavily preparing for that for pre-event and an event that we have talking to communities, to hospitals. We're trying to do more coordination and collaboration on how we can protect the health of our citizens. But we still continue with emerging issues. West Nile virus is something that doesn't really fit anywhere, but it's still under the purview of public health. So we've been dealing with that as well as ongoing with TB. It has not subsided. It's getting better in our county, but it takes a great deal of staff time around direct observed therapy and just daily needs of that. We also are responsible to be available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days of the year. And with the decreases in funding, that will affect our nursing capacity, and those are the people that need to do the investigations, the follow-up of the reportable diseases. And it's a critical piece right now how we can respond in a timely manner to those reported diseases and do the necessary work to take care of the community's health. So I encourage you to ask any questions if you want. And
has the health department identified who's going to get immunized for smallpox yet? I mean, are we to that point yet?
Each of the counties has a responsibility to identify a core. Well, we're in the process of that, and I'll tell you, it's been quite a challenge because there's a 5-page document you need to go through with the individual, and several people get screened out in that. Mm-hmm. And so we need to identify people, number one, who can take the vaccine and then who can be trained to give the vaccine. So it's one of those little pieces of detail that looks fine on paper, but it's really hard to implement.
Just
thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Rob Rockstrom, the Director of Lane County Health and Human Services, and I'm here today actually for AOCMHP, which is Association of Oregon Community Mental Health Programs. And so what you have is a paper we passed out. I just wanted to show you, page 2, I have it turned to page 2, legislative cuts. I really appreciate the clients coming here today because that's what this is truly all about. If you look at the list of the number of individuals losing services, and it's a gross summary, but you see it's over 51,000 there, and it's about a $27 million loss. I don't intend on going over that sheet. I just want to get it there for the record so you can see there are lots of lives impacted, and I certainly don't have the passion the same as the client does because nothing can replace them telling their real story. One of the things that I want to make sure everybody really understands that, you know, when we look at all the budgets, when my commissioners ask me locally what I look at, I just don't look at the e-board cuts or basically, the special session cuts. I have to look at the whole package. Plus, I have adult parole and probation, so my county have to look at Department of Corrections, community correction cuts. And the reality is they are a provider of services, too, in the arena where we overlap. So that's some significant impacts. And if I broadly look at it, we have cuts that are much broader than we're actually just looking at today in just DHS. Another thing I want to make sure we emphasize, a lot of cuts really, in my view of the world, don't be cuts right off the bat. They're really the shifts. There'll be cuts eventually. There'll be cuts in funding to providers and to counties, but they're really shifts. Like, for example, you heard today that if you cut the DARTS programs, the intent would be maybe a shift to schools. Schools don't have the ability to pick that up. Schools right now are not adequately funded by the federal mandate. They're certainly not adequately funded locally. So even though we say that's the shift, sure, that's the first people we'll ask. They have the ability to do it? Probably not. Yet something will happen because there are mandates around it. If you look at, for example, the alcohol and drug cuts, the reality is to a certain degree your local law enforcement, your sheriff's departments, or jails will have that impact. There's no doubt about it. If you look at a study done by Marion County, I wish I'd brought it today, I believe it was 211 methadone clients. And it's a very, very detailed study, but very interesting, especially when you get down to what's going to happen in real life when these cuts, what's going to happen to your life. Very interesting in reports about them on criminality and basically just decompensating, which is probably very realistic. We did not do a study in Lane County. I think we have about 300 clients combined between us and the two nonprofit agencies. I would assume it would be very, very similar. There's no doubt about it. If you look at the history of where a lot of the methanol clients came from, it was from criminality. I'm not going to argue that every client's a criminal, but the system can't have, in our case, 75% of the clients would not be eligible. That's crazy. Something just that doesn't make sense to me. If we look at other parts of the copays are really just a shift to the provider. And if you understand the copays, I understand it saves the state money, but if you even look at just a simple billing, somebody has a copay $3, $5, the accounting system to actually get that, mail it out, and do it, it's a loser. Actually, it's cheaper sometimes just to kiss it off, so you've totally shifted the providers. The other one, delay in billing, is the same sort of thing. Someone presents an emergency room, the hospital doesn't get stiffed for the first for that first day of service, unless there's a carve-out, which I don't think there is for presenting in some cases. But if you really think about it, the first time you present, the first time somebody will talk about eligibility, it's out a month later, again, just a huge shift. And the argument I would have, it's either a shift to local governments or to providers, which are frequently nonprofits or nonprofit hospitals. So it's, again, just largely shifts. When we had cuts previously, and I've only been in the state 16 years, we could handle a lot of the cuts because we're slack in the system. So, for example, if I had to collapse a development-disabled home, something didn't work out well, I could shift somebody to Eastern Oregon, Southern Oregon. We sort of worked with each other. You heard today there's a lot of cuts. We don't have that ability anymore. The slack is out of the system. We just don't have that ability. So, you know, when people ask, what are we going to do? I mean, I've been working in health and human services for 27 years, and I'm not sure what we're going to do. Some of it I really honestly don't know. Some of it I do know, but a lot of it I don't know. One of the things I just want to comment on, the crisis cuts to counties, that came out of the blue. I had no idea it was going to come that way. Sort of expected crisis cuts to be cut next year, not now. We are in the middle in our county of trying to decide what letter we might send to the state about the extended care management unit, basically saying they're not going to reimburse us for committed people at our hospital. Wayne County is the only county in the state that owns its own psychiatric hospital. So if someone's not going to reimburse me for a state committed client, they're going to get pushed out the door. Pushed out the door is not a nice thing. In the past, we have, I'm not thrilled by this, we've actually done court orders to drop somebody to the state. If they're committed, they legally belong to state, don't belong to me. Not a good way to do system planning, but we have very limited choices if I have to make room in the end for somebody with more acuity. The other thing is we are doing things. We're not just watching. It's not that I have a lot of good answers, but, for example, in Lane County, for the crisis cuts that would become effective in the next few weeks, we're going to shift some funding temporarily. I have to. I don't get any choice. Just because the state doesn't fund for a crisis doesn't mean there are no crises. I mean, that's just not reality. So at least temporarily I'm going to do something. All I'm really trying to do is buy time to plan, because if you look at the rebalance cuts we had, the e-board cuts and potential cuts for next year, planning is not anybody's great strength lately. This is not a rational model. I'm not arguing we always do rational models, but we need some more time for planning. Also, for example, we actually had our own pharmacy internally in mental health. We can't afford it anymore, but we just recently bid out a contract to a private organization, a corporation, who will be doing pharmacy work for us. We're trying to get some backup. Again, they will bill clients, so if you're medically needy, you may not have access. We're actually putting in some of our money to pay for funds for clients for meds. Again, that's a temporary measure, because you can't dump on clients. You cannot take a client on psychotropics and just say, you're cold turkey next month. We had three clients, and we told them in the last month or so, three clients tell us they're going to kill themselves. Not unusual for a mental health client to say they're going to kill themselves. Except in one case specifically, Steph told me when she tried to cut off her hand. I said, what do you mean? She just slashed herself? No, she actually cut her hand off previously. So I take it seriously if someone would cut off her hand previously when not on meds, she may try it again, may try to kill herself. And I wish the client were here to tell a story. To me, it's a hearsay thing. But these things do happen, given how many thousands of clients you have, and given the acuity when they're not on the meds, it's going to be a problem. Also, Lane County, we recently applied for a federally qualified health center. I do not like, personally, the shifts in the Oregon Health Plan that happened recently. I think they're terrible. I think we have a public purpose for certain clients we're obligated to take care of. I think if my sheriff were here, he'd back me up on this and how we do it. I really want to look at how we redo the Oregon Health Plan. And doing that, I would cut off access. I'm a fan of access normally. I wouldn't do it right now. But what we're trying to do in our county, because of the Federally Qualified Health Center, we could probably guarantee some access. I can't say everybody can do that. We're in for an application. I think we're going to get it. But I know access is a big issue, but would you give access right now and cut up public clients, for example, 75% of people in methadone clinic, to give access to a different population? It doesn't make a lot of sense to me right now. I want people to understand I am a fan of access, however you can get it, public or private. The copays. We have agreed in Lane County for at least for a period of time, we'll pay the copays for clients. It's just who don't have the ability to pay. It's relatively small for us, extremely large for them. I don't want them making the choice they're going to eat or not eat just to pay a $3 copay. It doesn't make a lot of sense to me. And the last thing I really would like, Not sure how we're going to do it yet. I'm a little confused. The Oregon Health Plan revisit. We've got to revisit the health plan, different models, and we can probably argue about a lot which way to go, but I think we need to have a good conversation on the Oregon Health Plan. And I think one of the things that our association will push for is I think the carve-out from alcohol and drug to primary care from mental health was not a good thing. If you look at our client base, you look at the clients present at the sheriff's office, we have an awful lot of dual diagnosis. We really have to talk about a behavioral health model. And I just think the whole funding has to be revisited. No, we cannot afford the Oregon Health Plan and what's going forward. I'm not a fan of that. We have to do something different, and I'm not sure what they are, but I'm willing to work on committees who want to work on that.
Questions? Thank you very much. Good to see you again.
Appreciate it. Thanks. I'm from Lorraine.
Yeah. It scares me when my constituents show up here. Mary Lou Ritter. Actually, didn't mean that. I welcome my constituents. You know, small joke.
Rob, could you come see me?
When?
Just whenever I get out of here.
Yes.
Yeah. I don't know when, but I want to talk about those carve-outs, because I agree with you on the, you know, carving out mental health.
You want to go now?
No. I
can I have my committee back now?
Thank you, Chair and committee. My name is Mary Lou Ritter. I'm a director in Washington County of Aging and Veterans Services, and I'm also chairman of the Oregon Association of Area Agencies on Aging and Disability, known as O4AD, of their legislative committee. I'm just grateful that I had a few minutes to recompose myself after hearing from the beneficiaries of Oregon's system of care and the impact of the loss of these services on them. I've been in the, what I call the aging business for over 30 years, and I came to Oregon after having worked in several states across America because Oregon had the national model of long-term care of options. And it's distressing to have worked here in Oregon now for over 15 years and see what the cuts have already done and what the cuts will do if Measure 28 is not successful. The single-page handout that I gave to you is a summary. I see that you have this nice multi-page spreadsheet, but I thought that on one sheet of paper you could see the cuts that have already taken place through the November and December period. The long-term care system and general funds has already lost $8 million, over $13 million in total funds. That's already disappeared through rate reductions that you're hearing about, through reductions in, like, the RSVP program, Retired Senior Volunteer Program, the elimination of 95% of the general assistance program, and miscellaneous cuts, including a huge cut to Oregon Project Independence, and I want to come to that in just a moment. The infrastructure, and you've heard it from several of the provider community representatives before you today, is a critical issue for you. You, as policy formers in budget development for Oregon, need to think about how do we finance the fact that we have an aging and disability community in Oregon that is growing. Medical science has made it possible for people to survive disability accidents that normally would have killed people. We have now people living into their 80s and 90s because of medical technology. We know that once you get to be age 80, the chances of getting a dementia is about half, about 50%. We know that as your body survives, your need in your ability to take care of yourself is often the biggest challenge that you'll face. Long-term care insurance, yeah, it's out there, but it's not a product that very many people buy. And in Oregon and across America, Medicaid, the state-financed system, is the long-term care insurance program for its citizens. Medicare doesn't even cover prescription drugs. And part of your issue as legislators is the fact that our national government does not have a prescription drug policy attached to Medicare. You know, if Oregon did not have the challenge of the prescriptions, you'd be in a whole different situation. But you can see a large number of these programs are going away because there is no prescription drug coverage there for medically needy. General assistance programs, those two are largely the prescription safety net for many people in Oregon. You've heard from people that came to you this morning talking about the consequences of not having those prescriptions. Unfortunately, you as legislators can't tell Congress to pass a Medicare prescription program. I know that in past sessions...
Actually, we can, but they don't listen.
Yeah, that's true. In fact, yes, I believe last session there was a joint resolution that, you know, say, hey, fix this. But the fact of the matter is that you're faced with this budget problem in part because of the prescription issue. And I can tell you that people survive because they're on medications. You've already heard from direct people today that are impacted by that. The other is that one of the delightful things about working in Oregon as a aging professional, aging in place, is that we have options, long-term care options. Many states, I get calls, my colleagues get calls from other states saying, how does Oregon do it? How do you get by with this average cost per person? The reason why we do it is because we have low-cost options. And I can tell you, when I started working in Washington County in 1986, I can remember this number really easy because I came in 86. We had 86 foster homes registered in Washington County. Washington County was the starting point of assisted living facilities. We had Karen Brown Wilson started Regency and Park Place. Regency and Park Place were the first two. And it was thrilling to be on the cutting edge of innovation. Now in Washington County, we have over 400 foster homes. We are probably the assisted living capital of the United States. Forest Grove is probably the capital, because we have the highest concentration of assisted living facilities, foster care. It goes on and on and on, and we've been able to innovate solutions that have saved you as the budget people lots of money and taxpayers millions of dollars. But I can tell you, with these rollbacks, that infrastructure is going to start to collapse. And it has taken us 10 years to develop these provider systems. We have a fledgling little bitty mental health, geriatric mental health program with our partner Tualatin Valley Centers. Most of the people that are going to be cut are recipients of that mental health program. When they are no longer eligible, then that program collapses, and we lose the only geriatric mental health program that we've got in our community. So you've heard testimony from the beneficiaries of many of these programs. I'm here to reinforce the fact that I'm worried, as a professional in this aging and disability business, that we're going to lose our infrastructure. We're going to lose our prescription drug coverage for lots of people, and that's going to shift the cost to more medical interventions that hospitals who, for the first time now, are actually on the profit side of the business, I don't think will remain there very much longer. The second part of the packet the one that's paper-clipped together for you, I'd like to draw your attention to the pink sheet. You've not heard from people today about Oregon Project Independence, and so I want to come to before you to reinforce the critical nature of this program. It is not a Medicaid program. We have, in fact, tried to research whether, in fact, we could get Medicaid funding. The feds say no. We're looking into whether or not we can tweak it to get some matching funds, but the fact of the matter is, this program serves low-income seniors who are as impaired as Medicaid clients but have a small residual amount of personal resources that they spend in partnership on Oregon Project Independence. They're on a sliding fee scale, so the state only subsidizes a small amount of their cost, but it's a critical cost. And often, the biggest benefit to the Oregon Project Independence person is the fact there's a case manager there who helps problem solve for them and find other community resources. Half of the Oregon Project Independence clients are over the age of 80. They're not young people. They are 75% are living on Social Security, and you've heard how much that is, $600, $700, not much. And about 40% of the our OPI people are below the poverty level. They're typically an older woman who lives alone. So you're talking about an 80-year-old lady living alone. Often there's not family around. At 80, how old are the kids? You've heard today, they're 60s, maybe 70s. So in here in this pink sheet, you'll see Ann Baxter is a typical client. She's actually 100 years old. And you can see the little house that she lives in. There's a myth about OPI that that you legislators are generously taking care of rich people. That is not true. We're talking about elders who are a very low income, who really don't want to give up their homes. And it's better for you and better for the taxpayers that we keep them in their homes for as long as possible. You've also, on the blue sheet, you'll see the priority paid services. You heard allusions to levels 10 through 15, 17, blah, blah, blah. Here's a brief summary of definitions for a level 1 person all the way down to what used to be. We used to serve down to level 18, but in the last session, services to that population was cut. Also then on the yellow pages, you'll see some profiles of what a level 1 OPI client. Now remember, OPI clients at level 1 are just the same as Medicaid clients at level 1. It's the same system. So you'll see here of a level 1 client of Jacob, then level down. So we wanted to provide you with profiles of a little mini case studies of what an OPI client or even a Medicaid client, what they might look like at these various levels. So as you're dealing with these issues and you're hearing, you'll see what a summary of those what those levels mean and to the people. Oregon Project Independence has already taken a sizable cut this year. In the November rebalance, it was over $800,000, almost $900,000. And then again in the December, there was over another $1 million cut. And the consequences of the constant five special sessions, there's every special session has been an elimination of OPI. Let's eliminate OPI. It's on and on and on. And the destabilizing nature of that is that some of the rural OPI programs are going to close. You can't manage a program on fits and starts. You start it up, you get threats that it's going to go away, so you're managing to this dollar figure. And what I heard yesterday from two of my counterparts in Oregon, two rural AAAs are going to close their program. They've already sent notices to their OPI clients that their program will end. That means that 25 or 30 seniors who have relied on this home care program to keep them in their homes are not going to receive that service. Now, we as AAAs are trying to figure out if we can help shore them up, but we're all cut. We've all been cut. I've lost in Washington County $250,000 this biennium, and I've laid off staff. We're down 43% of the hours. We're down more than half on the clients. And these people are calling us saying, what do we do? Their families are calling up mad at us, much like the poor beneficiary that you heard earlier today. We as bureaucrats, we don't have the answers. And so when we say we don't know, it makes people mad. And we don't have the answers. We manage with the dollars we have. We do the best we can. We're compassionate. We try and link them into other resources. But we are the safety net, and when that safety net is cut, people fall through, and it's really distressing. It's very distressing. And so I wanted you to hear from a professional, aging professional, and I feel about 10 years older today than I did 6 months ago. But I'm here, I'm hanging in here because I'm also an advocate for the people in our communities, and I'm a partner with you to help you in any way that we can as an association keep you up to date on what's going on, and thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you very much. Karen Stevens.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
My name is Karen Stevens, and I'm a screener at the Psychiatric Crisis Center. We're part of Marion County Mental Health, and we currently are the only 24-hour, 7-day-a-week service available to chronically and severely mentally ill citizens in Marion County. By offering around-the-clock services and support to these clients, we are able to serve them in their own communities, avoiding costly and extremely limited acute care services. Last month alone, we took over 3,500 calls, that's in 1 month, for services, and screened 367 clients, 116 in the hospital emergency rooms, and 251 at the crisis service itself. We expect the clients needing our services to increase dramatically as their prescription services, counseling services, other outpatient services are cut. So these numbers are going to go up. With the cuts proposed by this House bill, our support will also end for these clients. We expect that they will quickly overwhelm the acute care services that are extremely limited in Oregon and be on the streets. Currently, our services offer alternatives to these acute care services. Hospital use in this county has decreased by about one-third in the last 4 years because of our services. In every other county, it's increased. So without these services, other 24-hour services and those acute care services are going to be overwhelmed, including the emergency rooms and police services, which will be required to care for these clients because we won't be there to do that. So I strongly urge you to reconsider cutting these services proposed in this House bill measure. Thanks.
Questions?
Any questions?
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Scott Ricker.
Good morning, Chairman Cruz, ladies and gentlemen of the committee. Thank you for your time and for your incredible attention to this issue. My name is Scott Ricker. I'm the clinical supervisor for ACES Counseling Center in Eugene, Oregon. The point of this meeting and of testimony is not lost on the depth of the problem. Certainly you know the problems from the testimony and from your own study. The problem, however, goes far beyond anything that Measure 28 may or may not fix. The immediate issue is in our profession of serving chemically dependent addicts and alcoholics, the immediate effects of the cuts that the E-Board made in the Oregon Health Plan. ACES Counseling is a nonprofit organization. We maintain offices in Lane, Linn, and Benton counties. We've been in service for over 21 years to the state of Oregon and our communities. We operate 23 outpatient alcohol and drug treatment programs in over 10 separate locations in those three counties. We employ an average over time of over 100 counselors and support staff and serve more than 1,700 Oregon Health Plan clients each year. On January 9th of this year, after the E-Board's definitive decisions, the executive director of our agency sent this message to all of our 100 staff members. The E-Board has refused to reverse the elimination of chemical dependency benefits from the Oregon Health Plan. It is gone. Measure 28 will have no impact on this decision. Therefore, about 50% of our client base will no longer have funding. Throughout the month of February, ACES will close the office at 84 Centennial Loop in Eugene. That's a 5,000-square-foot facility that we are fortunately able to get out of the lease because the lease is coming due. The speed of the cuts that was made by the legislature gave nonprofit organizations no planning opportunities to make the necessary adjustments. The staff at 84 Centennial Loop will be reduced by 40%, and the remaining staff will move to the smaller space at 1461 Oak Street. The Bridge program, which serves parole and probation clients, I'm glad that Rob Rockstrow was here and able to share his concerns about the effects that chemical dependency treatment cuts are going to have on law and order in Oregon. ACES operates the Bridge program, specifically dedicated to parole and probation clients that have chemical dependency problems. That program will be reduced by 50% up front. All but 40 of the most needy clients must be discharged by February 28th. Your staff will also be cut proportionately. What that means is that high-risk clients that are a risk to themselves and others will immediately be put back out on the street because there is no funding for them. They're a risk to themselves and others, as illustrated by the fact that we have recently had two late-stage alcoholics die in Lane County while in our care, which is a devastating event and only an illustration of the severity of the disease of alcoholism. Certainly law enforcement agencies have told you of the documented, researched, substantiated association between chemical dependency and law and order. Just about any law enforcement agency will tell you that over 90% of their caseload is directly involved with alcohol and other drugs. So this clientele, approximately 40 clients, is going to be put back out on the street for lack of funding, despite the fact that ACEs and other chemical dependency agencies in this state are mandated by state law to operate under the auspices of the American Society of Addiction Medicine, which says that a client must receive appropriate levels of care. These 40 clients are going to be put back out on the street whether they need care or not. And what they will tell you, and what, in fact, they did tell you in a massive postcard mailing campaign, was that, and this is not directed at you personally as committee members, but to the legislature, nothing that you own is worth more than $20 to any addict or alcoholic. Nothing. Because they will break into your homes to support their habit. They will break into your car. Nothing you own is worth more than $20 to somebody who wants to score their next bag, their next line, their next bottle. The staff of the Bridge program must immediately be reduced. The Bridge program will move from its current location into the 1040 Oak office along with the drug court program. This is going to be an incredible shoehorn event to squeeze high-risk clients in with counselors trying to do triage. The drug court program in Lane County must discharge all but 71 of the most high-need clients. We currently serve over 150 clients in our drug court program in Lane County. Because the Oregon Health Plan is disappearing, we must now try to triage the remaining clients, the most high-need clients. That amounts to 36 clients are going to be graduated early out of the program. Basically, your felony has been expunged. Thank you very much. Over 17 clients will be discharged early from the ACEs program back into the monitoring care of the court, where they will appear once a month. They will receive no chemical dependency care. They will only be monitored by the court in an attempt to try to get these people to remain clean and sober and not to commit new crimes. Anyone in the program of this from the 150 clients that does not fall into one of those two categories must immediately be terminated from the program. They'll be put back out on the street, they'll receive a felony, and they will be sent to the Bridge program, which now also has no funding. The drug court must discharge all but the 71 most needy clients. Your staff will be cut by 40%. I have the task of returning to a staff meeting at 1 o'clock today to inform those staff members exactly who they are that will lose their jobs. And I would ask that you please excuse my today's attire. A suit and a tie are not what I typically wear to work. I deal with highly skilled professionals that are dealing with people who live and work in the streets. They live under bridges. Some of them are productive citizens holding down jobs, raising families. The only credentials that my suit might serve is to gain an appearance before you. The office at 1639 Oak Street must be closed. The NOVA program, which is our nonviolent alternative to domestic violence, the NOVA program will have to move into the Springfield office, which is, again, a shoehorn operation. The Springfield programs, which consist of outpatient and intensive outpatient programs, the Springfield programs must reduce your staff by 40% to match the loss of clients. The Juntos program, which is our Spanish-speaking Latino outpatient program, the Juntos program must reduce your staff by 40%. We'll be reduced to one counselor. We had the capacity to serve 60 Latino clients in Spanish. We'll now be reduced to one counselor. We can hope to serve 15 clients in Lane County only. Lynn and Benton counties will lose services. The Cottage Grove office is highly uncertain as to what its future might be. In all likelihood, it will have to be closed. The staff is hereby reduced to one counselor. The Florence office is undecided, but the staff must be reduced. The Corvallis will be centralized after determining the fate of the drug court and reliance programs. The staff must be reduced by 40%. Albany and Lebanon will centralize. The Lebanon office will be closed. Services to Cresswell and Oak Ridge will not be possible. Administrative staff will be reduced by 50%. Ladies and gentlemen, what this all boils down to is another example of what you know to be the problem. As Karen Gillette pointed out to you, in Lane County alone, the identification and treatment of infectious diseases is a major health issue. Chemical dependency treatment is mandated by the state of Oregon to be one of the agencies, one of the venues in our society that identifies communicable diseases. We must screen every client that comes in the door for their risk for tuberculosis, hepatitis C, HIV, and then make appropriate referrals. We will not be serving over 1,700 clients in Lane, Lynn, and Benton counties anymore to be able to identify those diseases. The rural services that were available to Cresswell, Cottage Grove, Oak Ridge will no longer be available. The impact to our program in direct money is received from the state will be approximately $1.25 million. We were providing outpatient services to our clients for approximately $735 per client. That's a bargain. For-profit agencies are charging anywhere from $1,200 to $4,000. We were providing a bargain to the state of Oregon. The direct economic impact of the layoffs, we'll have to lay off at least 40 staff members. The immediate economic impact will be in the neighborhood of $1.5 million to the Oregon economy and to human beings, to people, to staff. highly trained professionals that are required by the state of Oregon to be certified as alcohol and drug counselors in order to provide services. 40 lost jobs. We will also be shutting down family treatment programs, adolescent treatment programs, rural services, women-specific treatment, and the state counselor training facilities available at ACES Counseling. Rather than to go on and on about only the effects to ACES Counseling, this isn't about trying to save jobs. The cuts have already been made. The announcements have already been made. People know that their jobs end on February 28th. As one gentleman already told you today, people are looking outside the state of Oregon. Mental health, human services, chemical dependency capacity in the state of Oregon is being rolled back about 50 years. We're moving back to a time of bus ticket therapy, when people who could not have their needs met in the state of Oregon were handed a one-way ticket to Redding, California, and dumped. In closing, I'd like to communicate the executive director of ACE's incredible displeasure and the board of directors with the speed in which these cuts were announced. Certainly you're looking for solutions, and one of the solutions that my director and my boss and the board of directors of ACES Counseling would like to suggest is that you begin by dismantling the bureaucracy, and that you begin by dismantling the Office of Alcohol and Drug Abuse Prevention. It won't serve any purpose anymore. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Paul Potter. By the way, committee, we are excused from the floor.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Paul D. Potter, and I'm the Regional Director for Addictions Treatment Services for Cascadia Behavioral Healthcare. I want to thank you for your incredible patience this morning, and I'm sure it's been difficult for us all to sit here and listen to some of these very heartrending stories. And one of the things that I was reflecting on as I was sitting here for the last 2.5 hours is how difficult it is to sit here with probably 6 pages of things that I would like to sit here and tell you about and have about 5 minutes in order to condense that down in some sort of meaningful thing that might be helpful. What I can say is I think that the state of Oregon is in deep financial difficulty, and that's not new news to you. But I think that this is going to require that we all are engaged in a process of dialogue that can help us look for solutions. And so I can sit here and go through the litany of all the cuts that it's going to mean to Cascadia Behavioral Health Care. There's going to be another set of numbers that it will be difficult for you to remember as you go through the next months here to try to figure out. And I do want to do that sort of briefly. And then I have a couple of comments on a couple of things that came to my mind as I was listening to other people who have testified here so very powerfully. First of all, I think that it's very difficult to sit here and talk about House Bill 5100 as an isolated event in history, because it's taken the place in a context of a series of cuts. House Bill 5100 in and of itself is probably cuts to most of our programs that we could absorb over time, and sure, people would not be served at the same level, but they wouldn't be devastating. So it's not just House Bill 5100 or Measure 28. And as everybody's testified here this morning, even if Measure 28 does pass, we're faced with another series of cuts that are going to inevitably come our way. So really the tension has to turn is, well, where do we go from here? How do we try to mitigate against these really untenable cuts? I don't hear anyone, either in the legislature, in the public, or in the provider community, that's saying these cuts are acceptable. And this is exactly what we need to do. So I think we can begin there as a place of agreement that these cuts are not acceptable, and trying to find ways in which we can come together and find some creative ways to look at how what we can do regarding that. The first cuts that really happened really began at the, on the outpatient level for alcohol and drug and mental health treatments, and they had to do with general fund cuts for outpatient for indigent clients, and you've heard all the testimony regarding some of those. But for our particular programs, it meant in Marion County, for example, $150,000 worth of cuts. That really translates into about 300 clients a year that would not get services. And then as the, if ballot measure 28 does not pass, there are further outpatient cuts and residential cuts. Give you one example of that. There would be, there's a small, residential program for women with children here in Marion County. It's called Her Place. That particular facility has had countless hours of community members' involvement, staff involvement. Many clients have gone through there. This particular cut would basically eliminate the funding for that program. We're working right now to figure out a way to restructure that program, change the services in a way that can still deliver some level of services. But it really sort of adds to the dilemma of many of these programs are put together for, through creative financing mechanisms that draw from a number of different funding sources. And as each one of those funding sources have gotten assailed over the last 18 months and 24 months, it becomes more and more difficult, becomes more difficult to be that creative in order to sort of pull out different ways in which to put the funding mechanisms together. A comment about the delay in eligibility for the Oregon Health Plan, that has a particular impact on both mental health and alcohol and drug clients. As many of you may know, alcohol and drug clients come to a moment in their life where they may be willing and motivated to do something about their problem. A 30-day delay in that will lose that therapeutic moment for us to be able to intervene and begin treatment for that individual. So it really is, it's devastating in that level in terms of moving with clients and going where they're at a time when they're willing to begin to make that move. The Measure 28 cuts on the mental health side, because Cascadia Behavioral Health Care is both alcohol and drug and mental health services. I want to spend just a moment talking about that. The residential mental health beds that are being cut are hitting the most vulnerable and is creating, as you well know, a real crisis in Multnomah County. The consumer-run employment programs will be cut. Those have been spoken to this morning. You've heard people talk about those. The crisis system cut. Backs at a time when we're trying very hard and we've had a six-month showing and being able to cut back on the use of high-priced hospital beds because of crisis systems have been set up in Multnomah County. With that crisis system now being cut back, and the most devastating of all those cuts probably is the money for general assistance for those people who have been screened who may have a disability that get general assistance as their way waiting determination on that. For those folks, that means that they're going to end up in the hospital, perhaps, inevitably in the hospital. Therefore, what that has is it takes money out of the outpatient pool, creating another downward cycle that we just now, after 6 to 8 months of very difficult operations, gotten a handle on or started to get a handle on in Multnomah County. Multiply all of these cuts that I've just talked about times the number of alcohol and drug and mental health programs that are throughout the state. Also, one other thing that hasn't been mentioned here this morning is the 2001 legislature diverted the DUII fine revenue from the intoxication diversion program funds to state police training. Those replacement funds that were put in by the 2001 legislature will run out at the end of February. And there are no new dollars that are coming into that system. And it's not likely that any new dollars will be forthcoming in this legislature, given the enormity of the task that you have in front of you in terms of balancing the budget. That has a devastating impact on those people who have been arrested for driving under the influence of intoxicants. And many of the statewide programs will be faced with having to turn away people who have received those and have been intervened on in a public safety sense and have an opportunity to come into treatment, and they will not have that opportunity due to those cutbacks. Finally, I just want to close with going back to my original statements of looking at, in the future, what can we do? There's been a lot of things that have proposed in terms of areas to look at, including DHS reorganization. As you well know, a lot of attention has been paid to whether or not the integration of DHS has really worked. I'm not even sure we know what measure to look at when we say, has that worked? I think that's something we need to take a look at. And Representative Westland, I know that you were interested in the looking at the carve-out of mental health and A&D. As we look at that, I certainly would encourage you to make sure that alcohol and drug providers and the Association of Alcohol and Drug Directors are at the table when that discussion goes on, because there have been some benefits to alcohol and drug being lined up under primary care relative to integration. One of my favorite things that I've learned, that I heard recently talking about integration, particularly as it relates to co-occurring disorders, is our clients are integrated, but we're not. And integration has become sort of a buzzword, but in reality, it's been extremely difficult to accomplish. And some of the things that have been brought out are, you know, are pertinent to that discussion. But I would just urge you to go carefully with that and really look at the reasons why there's been a separation for mental health and alcohol and drug at a state level for many years. And let's not repeat the mistakes of that integration might do. And so I just urge you to be careful and go cautious in that regard and learn from our future. I have a lot of other things that I could say, and I know in the interest of time I will not say that. I just want to thank you very much for allowing public testimony on this very important issue.
Thank you very much. Okay. And batting cleanup, Elizabeth Beyer.
Thank you very much, Representative Cruz, members of the committee. My name is Elizabeth Byers, and I'm here representing Project Equality. It's a project of the Oregon Health Action Campaign and the Mental Health Association of Oregon. You know, we want to provide some input about possible sources of revenue. And in that, I want to point out we've got a report by Families USA, if anybody wants a copy. Came out this month. It's called Medicaid, Good Medicine for State Economies. There's a lot of Oregon-specific figures in here, and we're working on data that talks about Oregon jobs that are supported by Medicaid dollars. So I think that's an important source of revenue. The next source of revenue we want to talk about is how many large employers are using the Oregon Health Plan as their employee health care benefit? We think those large employers could be supporting the Oregon Health Plan financially besides encouraging their employees to participate in it. You know, they studied in Georgia. They have Oregon Health Plan there. They call it Georgia Peach. And Georgia Peach was studied to see who are the largest employers who use Georgia Peach as their employer-based health insurance. And it turned out Walmart was the biggest user of Georgia Peach at 10,000 employees on Georgia Peach working for Walmart. So maybe we should be doing those studies here and asking those employers to contribute to the cost of the program, not just the outreach. I applaud them doing the outreach. We want them to help support the program as well. We have some other suggestions for revenue. You know, in September we voted to, or legislature voted to include Sundays as a day that liquor stores could be open. Just as an aside, I live here in Salem. Although our liquor stores are open on Sunday, we can't take a bus to go there because we don't have bus service on Sundays. But that, liquor stores are now open an extra day, but they have not, we've not asked anybody to pay any more liquor taxes to support drug and alcohol treatment. It really seems like a natural partnership, and we're hoping that you're going to look into that. We also are hoping you're going to look into a higher cigarette tax, making us compatible with California and Washington, so those folks aren't coming from California and Washington to buy cheaper cigarettes here and not paying a tax to support the treatment of the diseases that smoking brings us. I also want to I also want to point out, relative to discussions about people who use services that they're not entitled to, and I would say there's a huge population of people who have worked for small organizations or been privately employed and don't give money into Social Security, so they're not able to get substantial Social Security benefits when they become disabled, but they're still people who work their whole lives and deserve to the support that Social Security and Medicare provides for those folks. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Elizabeth. And I want to thank everybody who stayed. It was important that we get through this today, so I want to thank the committee, and we are adjourned. Thank you.